A Time to... by Wilbur Smith. Read by Tim Pigott-Smith. Side 1. She had sat for over 2 hours without moving, and the need to do so was an almost unbearable affliction. She was staring through the eye slit of the hide, down a narrow tunnel that the gun-bearers had cleared through the thick bush. The tunnel was 60 yards long, paced out so the telescopic sight of the rifle could be zeroed precisely. Without moving her head, Claudia swiveled her eyes towards her father. His rifle was propped in the V of a branch, and even in her discomfort, the thought of her father firing that weapon made her angry. He had always filled her with violent and conflicting emotions. He dominated her life, and she hated him and loved him for it. The main reason she was still unmarried at 26 years, despite the way she looked, despite her own singular achievements, was this man beside her. She had never found another to compare with her papa. Colonel Ricardo Montero, soldier, engineer, scholar, millionaire, sportsman, how many descriptions fitted him perfectly, and yet did not describe the kindness and the strength that made her love him, the cruelty and ruthlessness which made her hate him. He was a dangerous man, and therein lay most of his appeal. Papa had all the charm and flashing golden brown eyes of his Latin origins, but although he had been born in Milano, the greater part of him was American, for Claudia's grandparents had emigrated to Seattle when Ricardo was a child. She had inherited his looks, but she had studied law as a direct defiance of his lawless streak. He was a Republican, so she was a Democrat. Because he set so much store by wealth and possessions, Claudia had turned down the very lucrative job she was offered after graduating in law, and had taken one in the Civil Rights Agency. Because Papa had commanded a battalion of engineers in Vietnam and still talked of gooks, her work with the Inuit people of Alaska gave her satisfaction, enhanced by his disapproval. Yet she was in Africa at his request. And the true horror of it was that he was here to kill animals, and that she was in collusion with him. At home, what spare time she had was devoted to working for the Alaskan Nature and Wildlife Conservation Society. Yet here she was, waiting submissively for him to assassinate some beautiful wild animal. Her own duplicity sickened her. But this might be the very last time she would be with him. Oh, God, she asked herself, what will I do without him? As the thought struck her, she turned her head and looked at the man behind her. He was the professional hunter, and Claudia had met him for the first time only 4 days previously at Harare. The hunter had flown them out in his twin-engined Beechcraft Baron to this vast and remote hunting concession near the Mozambique border, which he chartered from the Zimbabwe government. Sean Courtney. Already she loathed him. Here was another dangerous man, hard, ruthless, and so good-looking that her every instinct shrieked a warning at her. He frowned at her with clear, bright green eyes in the darkly tanned face. Annoyed at her movement, he touched her hip with one finger, cautioning her to stillness. The touch was light, but the spot on her hip burned as though he had branded her. She forced herself to sit still, and almost immediately she felt the shift of the light evening breeze. Sean had sighted the hide below the prevailing wind, and now, as the breeze came down to them, it brought the stench of the carcass. The bait was an old buffalo cow Sean had selected from a herd. It was the first animal Claudia had ever seen killed deliberately. The crash of the heavy rifle had shocked her, but not as deeply as the scarlet gush of blood and the mournful death bellow of the old cow. Sean and his trackers had butchered the carcass and hauled it up into the lower branches of the wild fig tree. That had been 4 days previously, and Claudia grimaced at the stench. While they waited, the sun sagged wearily down the sky, and in the undergrowth down on the banks of the stream, a lowry called as raucously as a parrot. Claudia became aware of a sudden tension in the hide. Her father was staring through his peephole, but she could not see what had excited him. From the corner of her eye, she saw Sean Courtney reach between them to grasp her father's elbow in a cautionary, restraining grip. "On the lift," Sean said, and her eyes swiveled. She saw something move like mist or smoke in the long, sun-seared grass. Then, abruptly, an animal stepped out into the open killing ground below the reeking carcass. Despite herself, Claudia gasped. It was the most beautiful beast she had ever seen. A great cat, sleek and glossy and golden. It turned its head and looked directly at her. Its throat was a soft cream, and sunlight gleamed on the long white whiskers. But the eyes were yellow, implacable, glowing, as it stared up at the wall of the hide. Claudia was frozen with excitement and dread. Only when the cat turned its head away and looked up at the carcass in the tree could she let out her breath in a soft, ragged sigh. "Don't kill it. Please, don't kill it," she almost cried aloud. With relief, she saw that her father had not moved. Only then did she realize that it was a female. There was no mane, and they were hunting only a full-maned lion. There were heavy penalties, huge fines, and even imprisonment for the killing of a female. She relaxed slightly and gave herself over to the stunning beauty of this beast. Claudia's pleasure had only just begun, for the lioness, satisfied that she was safe, gave a low, mewling call. Almost immediately, her cubs came tumbling into the clearing. There were three of them, fluffy as children's toys, and dappled with their kitten spots. They tripped over paws, wrestling and falling over each other with ferocious baby growls. The lioness rose up on her hind legs to reach the dangling carcass and began to feed. Then a second lioness stepped into the clearing, followed by two half-grown cubs. This lioness was much darker, and her pelt was criss-crossed with old healed scars, the legacy of a lifetime of hard hunting. Her ribs showed through the scarred hide. The two cubs that followed her would probably be her last litter. Next year, when she was too weak to keep up with the pride, the hyena would take her. But now she was still living on her cunning and experience. She mistrusted the dangling carcass and prowled restlessly around the clearing. Every so often she stopped and stared intently down the open lane to the grass wall of the hide at the far end. The young lioness dropped back on all fours, ripping flesh from the buffalo. One young cub rushed under her belly and attached himself to a nipple. The lioness ignored it and rose once more on her hind legs. The cub fell back under her back paws, his dignity trampled, as she tugged at the bait. He crawled out between her legs, dusty and disheveled. Claudia giggled. Immediately, Sean dug her hard in the ribs. The rest of the pride were too preoccupied, but the old lioness reacted, crouching and flattening her ears against her skull, staring fixedly down the opening at the hide. With these eyes on her, Claudia lost any urge to giggle again. For long seconds, those eyes bored into hers. Then, abruptly, the old lioness rose and slid away into the thick undergrowth. Claudia let out her breath slowly. While the rest of the pride tussled and fed beneath the bait tree, the sun slid below the treetops, and the short African twilight was on them.
"If there's a Tom with them, he'll come in now," Sean breathed softly.
Claudia heard something beyond the grass wall beside her, a furtive brush of some creature in long grass. Then she heard an unmistakable sound, the footfall of some heavy creature, soft and stealthy, and she felt her skin crawl with fear. Quickly she turned her head. Her left shoulder was pressed up against the thatch wall, and there was a chink. Through it, she saw movement, and a tiny expanse of smooth, tawny hide filled the hole. As she stared in horror, the tawny pelt slid past her eyes, and she heard a snuffling at the far side of the thatch wall. Instinctively, she reached behind her. Her hand was seized in a hard, cool grip. The touch that had offended her only minutes before now gave her more comfort than she had ever believed possible. She did not even marvel that she had reached for Sean's hand rather than her own papa's. She stared into the chink, and suddenly there was another eye beyond, a huge round eye, glistening like yellow agate, a terrible inhuman eye, unblinking, burning into hers with a dead black pupil in its centre, a hand's span from her face. The lioness's nostrils were filled with man odour, and she let out an explosive grunt that seemed to rock the flimsy grass walls. Claudia caught the scream in her throat before it could escape. Then the yellow eye was gone, and she heard the pad of great paws circling back round the hide. Claudia swiveled her head to follow the sound, and she looked straight into Sean's face. There was a grin on his lips, and mockery in those green eyes. Her terror subsided, and her anger flared. She wanted to jerk her hand out of his grip, but she could still hear that great cat out there, still very close, circling them, and she knew that without his grip, she would not be able to control herself. So she held on, but she turned her face away. The killing ground below the bait tree was deserted, and within minutes it would be dark. Claudia thought longingly of the Toyota that was parked a mile back up the track. Her father asked softly,
"When did you tell the gunbearers to bring the truck?" "After the last of the shooting light," Sean answered him quietly. "Another 15 minutes.
The lioness growled threateningly.
"Cheeky bitch," Sean said cheerfully. "Snarly Sue in person."
"Shut up," Claudia hissed at him. "She'll find us."
"Oh, she knows we are here now," Sean replied,
and then raised his voice and called,
"Get away with you, you silly old bitch. Go on back to your babies."
Claudia jerked her hand out of his grip.
"Damn you, you'll get us all killed."
But the loud human voice had alarmed the cat, and there was silence beyond the grass wall. Sean took up the .577 Nitro Express that was propped against the wall beside him.
"Now listen to me, Capo,"
he addressed Ricardo.
"If we kill that old whore without good reason, the game department is going to pull my license. Good reason is when she's already chewed somebody's arm off, not before. Do you hear me?"
"I hear you,"
Ricardo nodded.
"All right, don't shoot until I tell you, or by God, I'll shoot you."
They grinned at each other, and Claudia realized with disbelief that the two of them were actually having fun.
"By the time Job arrives with the truck, it'll be pitch dark, and Job can't get the truck up to the hide. We'll have to go down to it in the riverbed. You go first, Capo, and then Claudia between us. Stay close together, and whatever you do, don't run."
They heard the lioness growl once more, and almost immediately she was answered from the far side of the hide. The young lioness was out there now.
"The gang's all here," Sean commented.
The hunters had become the hunted, and the darkness was almost complete.
"Where's the truck?" Claudia whispered.
Sean said,
"It's coming."
Then his voice changed.
"Down," he said sharply. "Get down."
And though she had heard nothing, Claudia dropped to the ground. The lioness had crept up to the front wall again, almost soundlessly, and now she flung herself at it, roaring furiously.
"Keep your heads down,"
Sean shouted, and lifted the rifle just as the wall burst open. He fired, and the muzzle blast filled the interior with brilliant flame. Claudia heard the startled lioness gallop away into the undergrowth, snarling viciously.
"You missed."
"Wasn't trying to hurt her," Sean reloaded. "Just a warning shot. There's the truck coming."
Ricardo's voice was unconcerned.
"Job heard the shot."
Sean stood up.
"All right, let's move out."
Claudia scrambled up and looked over the low grass wall into the forbidding dark. In the trees not 50 yards away, the lioness roared again.
"Noisy blighter," Sean chuckled. "Take hold of Capo's belt."
Gently, he guided Claudia's hand to her father's belt at the small of his back.
"Hold on," he told her, "and whatever happens, don't run. It'll pull them onto you instantly."
Sean switched on a big black mag light, but even that powerful beam seemed puny in the immensity of the forest. They went slowly, bunched up tightly, and each time the torchbeam picked up the flash of Cat's eyes, they seemed closer, until Claudia could make out the body of the animal behind the glowing eyes. Nimble and restless, they circled, both lionesses, closing in now, pacing swiftly through the undergrowth.
"Here comes Snarly Sue,"
Sean warned quietly as the old lioness screwed up her courage and came at them out of the night, grunting like a steam locomotive, her long tail lashing from side to side. They stopped in a tight group, and Sean swung the torch and the rifle onto the charging animal.
"Get out of it!" he yelled. "Go on, scat!"
The lioness came on, her ears flattened against her skull.
"Yeah, Snarly Sue!"
Sean howled.
"I'll blow your stupid head off!"
She broke her charge at the last possible moment, skidding to a halt on stiff front legs, 10 feet from where they were bunched.
"Piss off!"
Sean ordered her sternly, and she turned and trotted obediently back into the forest. Sean chuckled.
"She was just trying it on."
"How did you know that?"
Claudia's voice was shrill in her own ears.
"Her tail. As long as she keeps waving it, she's only kidding. When she holds it stiff. Then, look out."
"Here's the truck," Ricardo said,
and they could see the Toyota's headlights through the trees as it bumped up the dry riverbed.
"It's not over yet,"
Sean warned, as they moved off down the track once more.
"There's still Growly Gertie to deal with."
Claudia had forgotten the younger lioness, and now she glanced around fearfully as she stumbled after her father. Then, at last, they were on the bank of the riverbed, fully lit by the headlights of the parked truck, which was standing only 30 yards away with its engine running. So close, so very close. Claudia let go of her father's belt and ran, pelting wildly through the thick, loose white sand of the riverbed. She heard Sean shout behind her, and immediately afterwards the grunting roar of the lioness as she charged. Claudia glanced sideways, and the great cat was almost on her, huge and pale in the headlights of the Toyota. For a vital instant, Sean had not realized that the girl had run. He had been watching the old lioness on the edge of the reed bed as she crawled on her belly towards them, when he heard the crunch of Claudia's running feet in the sand, and he whirled and saw her out there in the dry river bed, alone.
"You bloody idiot!"
he yelled in fury. He barged past Ricardo, and the lioness burst out of the reeds. The riverbed was brilliantly lit by the lights of the truck, so Sean dropped the torch and swung up the rifle with both hands. But he could not fire. The angle was wrong. The girl was between him and the lioness. He shouted,
"Fall flat!"
But she kept running, blocking his shot. And the lioness swept in on her, roaring with each stride, her tail stiff and straight. In the headlights, the shadows of girl and cat on the stark white sand were grotesque and black, and Sean saw the lioness gather herself for the leap. Impossible to separate them, impossible to fire without hitting the girl. At the last moment, Claudia tripped and sprawled face down in the sand. Instantly, Sean zeroed in on the creamy chest of the lioness. He could send a bullet through the lioness and it would be the end of the cat, the safari, and probably his license. Sean dropped his aim. It was a terrible risk, but he thrived on risk. He fired into the sand, 2 feet in front of the lioness's open jaws. The huge heavy bullet ploughed in, sending up an eruption of sand that enveloped the animal. Sand filled her mouth and was sucked into her lungs as she roared. Sand drove into her nostrils, clogging them. Sand lashed into her open yellow eyes, disorientating her, breaking the charge instantly. Sean raced forward, with the second barrel ready to fire. But it wasn't necessary. The lioness was bounding into the reed bed. Sean jerked Claudia to her feet, half-dragged her to the Toyota, and bundled her into the front seat. Ricardo scrambled into the back, and Sean leapt up onto the running board, his rifle pointed out into the darkness, ready for another charge.
"Go!"
he shouted at Job, and they flew down the riverbed. Nobody spoke for almost a minute, until they had climbed out of the riverbed onto the smoother track. And then Claudia said, in a small, strangled voice,
"If I can't pee right now, I'm going to burst.
Ricardo let out a delighted guffaw of nervous relief. And in that moment, Sean admired Claudia's spirit and liked her more than he had done in all the time he had known her. Claudia Montero wore a dress for dinner that evening, a floating silk chiffon in pure white with silver and turquoise Seminole jewellery. Against her tan skin and jet-black hair, the effect was stunning. The men were already at the campfire, and she was gratified when they stopped talking and watched her make her entrance.
"Get the lady a peg," Sean ordered the mess waiter.
The waiter brought it to her on a silver tray. It was perfect. A dash of Chivas whiskey in a crystal glass, barely enough to colour the Perrier water, and filled right up with ice. The waiter was dressed in a snowy white Kanza robe, a scarlet sash over his shoulder, and a scarlet pillbox fez on his head. His two assistant waiters stood in the background, also in scarlet fez and flowing white robes. 20 servants, to care for 3 of them. It was all so sybaritic and colonial and exploitative. This was 1987, for God's sake, and the Empire was long gone. But the whiskey was delicious.
"I suppose you expect me to thank you for saving my life," she said, as she sipped it.
"Not at all. I was worrying more about having to kill the lioness. Now that would have been tragic."
They fenced, lightly, skillfully, and Claudia found herself enjoying it. She was disappointed when the head waiter announced that dinner was ready. Sean led them into the dining tent that was lit by a many-branched candelabra. The conversation turned to animals, particular animals. Legendary old males for which Sean had pet names. One such animal he referred to as Frederick the Great, or simply Fred. This was the lion they were hunting now.
"I've seen him twice this season. One client even had a shot at him, but he was shaking with nerves and missed him by a football field."
"Tell me about him." Ricardo leaned forward eagerly.
"Papa, he told you about him last night," Claudia reminded him sweetly. "And the night before, and the night before that."
"Little girls should be seen and not heard," Ricardo chuckled. "Tell me about Fred."
Again.
"Well, he's got to be well over 11 foot, and he's got a head on him like a hippo, and a mane like a black haystack. When he walks, it ripples and tosses like the wind in a masasa tree," Sean rhapsodized. "Cunning, sly, Fred knows it all. He didn't get that big by being stupid."
"How are we going to get him?" Ricardo demanded.
"I think the two of you are disgusting," Claudia cut in. "After seeing those glorious creatures today, those beautiful little cubs, how can you bring yourself to kill them?"
"I didn't see any cubs shot today," Ricardo remarked. "In fact, we went to a great deal of trouble and risk to ensure their survival."
"You're devoting 45 days of your life to the sole purpose of killing lions and elephants," Claudia shot back.
"I'm always fascinated by the confused thought process of your average shrieking liberal," Sean intervened.
And Claudia turned on him. "There's no confusion in my mind. You're here to kill animals."
"The same way that a farmer kills animals," Sean agreed. "To ensure a healthy, flourishing herd and a place for that herd to survive."
"You're not a farmer."
"Oh, yes, I am," Sean contradicted. "And like any farmer, my chief concern is the survival of my breeding stock. Like anything else, the wild game of Africa has to pay its way, if it's going to survive. Capo here is paying tens of thousands of dollars to hunt a lion and an elephant, so the government of Zimbabwe is willing to set aside concessions of millions of acres in which the game can persist. I hire one of those concessions, and I have the strongest incentive in the world for protecting it from poachers and making certain I have plenty of game to offer my hunters. No, Ducky, legal safari hunting is one of the most effective arms of conservation in Africa today."
"So you're going to save the animals by shooting them with high-powered rifles?" Claudia demanded scornfully.
"Would you prefer us to use low-powered rifles? Wouldn't that be rather like demanding that the butcher uses only blunt knives to cut throats? Think with your head, not your heart."
"The individual animal
is unimportant. What is beyond price is the continued existence of the species as a whole. Our lion is an old male at the end of his useful lifespan. He's added his genes to the pool of his race, and he'll die naturally within the next year or two. Much better that his death produced $10,000 in cash, which will be spent on providing a safe place for his cubs to live, than having this wilderness encroached upon by swarming black humanity and their scrawny herds of goats.
My God, listen to you.
Claudia shook her head. Swarming black humanity, the words of a racist and a bigot. It's their land. Why can't they be free to live where they choose?
And that is the logic of woolly-headed liberalism, Sean laughed. Make up your mind whose side you're on, the beautiful wild animals or the beautiful wild blacks. You can't have it both ways. When the two come into competition for living space, the wild animals always come off losers, unless we hunters can pay the bill for them.
Sean Courtney, Claudia conceded, wasn't an easy man to argue with. When they trooped out to the hunting car next morning, they found Job and Shadrach, the two Matabeles, standing in the back, with the little Ndorobo tracker, Matatu, between them. The tracker only came up to Claudia's armpit, but he had an endearing grin and bright, mischievous eyes. They drove slowly over the winding, bumpy track, and as the night retreated before the advance of dawn, Sean switched off the headlights. The dusty track was pocked with the spoor of the animals that had crossed in the night. Once they came across the fresh droppings of an elephant, still steaming in the chill of dawn, which everybody climbed out of the Toyota to examine closely.
Old beggar, Sean said.
How do you know that? Claudia demanded.
Can't chew his food, he replied. Look at the twigs and leaves in the dung. Almost whole.
Is it him?
Ricardo asked.
Matatu will tell us, Sean shrugged.
The little Ndorobo spat in the dust and stood up, speaking to Sean in piping falsetto Swahili.
Nah, it's not the one. Matatu knows this bull, Sean translated. He has one tusk broken off at the tip and the other worn down to a stump.
You mean Matatu can recognize a particular elephant by his footprints?
Claudia looked incredulous.
Matatu isn't a tracker, Sean exaggerated a little for her. He's a magician.
Just before sunrise, Sean parked the Toyota at the foot of a rocky hill that rose abruptly out of the forest. They climbed the side of the kopje, 300 feet of uneven pathway, and looked out over a panorama of forest and glade that glowed with golden grass to other high kopjes standing like fairy castles, turreted and towered in the dawn. They sat on the front edge of the hill and played their binoculars over the forest below. Behind them, Job got a fire going. Sean pointed.
That's the Mozambique border over there. Just 7 or 8 miles from here. 12 years of Marxism, corruption, greed, and incompetence just beginning to bear fruit with a civil war raging out of control, famine that will probably starve 1 million people, and epidemic disease that will kill 1 million in the next 5 years.
Sounds like a fun place for a vacation, Ricardo said.
How about breakfast, Job?
Job brought them plates of eggs and bacon, followed by mugs of strong coffee. You're a pretty good cook, Job, Claudia told him.
Thank you, ma'am,
Job answered quietly. He was a tall, powerful man in his late 30s, with wide-spaced, intelligent eyes. When did you learn?
In the Rhodesian army, ma'am, Job said in his deep, soft voice.
Job was a captain in the Ballantine Scouts, with me, Sean explained.
A captain? Claudia exclaimed. Oh, I didn't realize. In fact, it amused Job to adopt this role in front of safari clients, calling Sean Bwana and acting out the charade of the bygone colonial era. At first, Sean had protested.
It's what the clients expect, Job had reasoned. We're selling them an illusion, man. They're playing Ernest Hemingway. If they guessed I had a master's in history and politics, it would frighten the hell out of them.
After the war, when the Lancaster House Agreement had given the country over to Robert Mugabe and his People's Democracy, Job had found himself branded. He had fought the war on the wrong side, the losing side, and he was a Matabele when the power was in the hands of the Shona tribe. Every door to advancement was barred against him. So Sean and he had hunted together as they had fought, side by side, and within a year, Sean had made him one of the directors of Courtney Safaris. Shadrach, the second gun-bearer, whistled softly. He was sitting 50 yards farther along the crest, and he pointed north. Sean went and peered down into the forest.
"What is it?" Ricardo called.
"Elephant," Sean replied.
Ricardo and Claudia sprang up and hurried to join them.
"Where? Where?" she demanded.
"Is it him?" Ricardo asked.
"Too far to be sure. A couple of miles."
Sean pointed out the indistinct grey blur amongst the trees.
"What do you think?" Ricardo asked. "Could it be Tukutela?"
"It could," Sean nodded, "but it's 1,000 to 1 against it."
Tukutela. Claudia had listened to them discussing this elephant at the campfire. Tukutela, the angry one, was one of those legendary animals of which there were only a handful left in the whole of Africa. A bull elephant with tusks that weighed over 100 pounds each. 3 years before, Ricardo had been on safari with Sean, and the two of them had followed the great elephant for 5 days. They had stalked to within 20 paces of the enormous ancient beast as he fed on the fruits of a marula tree. They were so close that they could have counted the remaining few hairs in his tail, the rest worn away over the years, and they had gazed in silent awe upon his ivory. Tukutela's tusks were black, stained with age and the sap of tall trees he had destroyed with them. They curved in towards each other, so the tips almost met 9 feet from his lip, and were without taper, solid columns of ivory, hanging so low that they drooped below the level of the grass, and seemed to overburden even that massive frame. Ricardo Montero would have paid any price to possess those tusks. He had asked Sean in a whisper,
"Isn't there any way I can have him?" "No, Keppo, we can't touch him. More than my license and my concession are worth."
For around his neck, Tukutela wore a collar, a sturdy thing of nylon, and suspended from it was a radio transmitter. Some years previously, the old bull had been darted for a research project, and while he was unconscious, they had riveted the collar around his neck. This made Tukutela a designated research animal, and placed him beyond the reach of legal safari hunters. 6 months ago, Tukutela had thrown his collar. Once again, he was legal game. The same day that Sean had heard the news, he had sent a cable to Ricardo in Alaska, and received a reply the following afternoon. And now, as Ricardo stood on the crest of the kopje, he was shaking with excitement. Claudia studied him with open amazement. She had seen him negotiating a $10 million contract without any visible emotion. But here he was, shivering with excitement, like a schoolboy on his first date. "I haven't understood just how much this means to him," she thought. "Perhaps I'm being too hard. This is the last thing in his life that he truly wants." And she wanted to hug him. Ricardo was not even aware of her existence.
"It could be Tukutela," he repeated softly.
Sean shook his head. "I've got 4 trackers watching the river. Tukutela couldn't cross without them knowing."
"He could have slipped through. It's just possible."
"We'll go down and take a look, of course." Sean nodded in agreement.
They went directly down the steep front slope of the kopje, leaping lightly from boulder to boulder. But it was almost an hour through the forest before Matatu picked up the huge dished spore in the soft earth. Matatu stopped, turning back to roll his eyes and give piping cries of disgust.
"It's not Tukutela. It's the old one-tusk bull," Sean told them. "He circled back this way."
Claudia watched her father's face and saw the intensity of his disappointment. Then Sean said softly,
You knew it wasn't going to be that easy, didn't you, Capo? And they grinned at each other. You're right, of course. The chase is everything. Once you kill, it's only dead meat.
Sean slept as lightly as a hunter and a soldier. At the light scratch on the canvas of his tent, he was instantly awake. The luminous hands of his Rolex pointed to 3 o'clock.
Who is it, Job?
One of the trackers has come into camp. He has run 20 miles. At sunset, to Kutela, crossed the river out of the national park.
They reached the ford on the Chiwewe River an hour before dawn. The waters were black and shining in the last beams of the moon, and the tall trees along either bank were a silvered host. Sean parked the Toyota well off the track and left one of the skinners to guard it. All the men, including Ricardo, were under field packs. Even Claudia carried her own water bottles. They moved upstream, and within a mile they had warmed up and were pushing harder. Sean noticed that Claudia moved well on those long legs of hers and was keeping up without difficulty. She gave him a grin as she noticed his appraisal. The dawn light was hardening when they came to Tukutela's crossing place, where a pod mahogany tree guarded a low place on the river bank. Matatu darted ahead, dabbing lightly at the earth with the tip of the peeled willow wand he carried.
"It's him," he chirped. "These are the feet of the father of all elephants. It is Tukutela."
The spoor was clear as a highway, following the game trail directly into the forest away from the river. They had started almost 10 hours behind the bull, but every time he had paused to feed, they cut that lead. The bull had now turned off the game trail and was following a stony ridge. He left no indications for the average human eye to follow, but Matatu went after him with complete authority. "What can he see?" Claudia wanted to know. "It's just rocks and gravel."
"The elephant's pads leave a scuff on the rock. They bruise the lichen, leave smears of dust. There is fine grass growing between the stones. He has bent the stems in the direction of his passing. The disturbed grass catches the light differently."
"Could you follow it?"
Sean shook his head.
"No, I'm not a magician."
In a gorge between two hills, water had been trapped in a narrow rock pool. It was stagnant and green, but the old bull had drunk from it and left a pile of his spongy yellow dung beside it.
"We'll take 10 minutes rest here," Sean told them. "You can drink now." He looked at Claudia. "But try to limit it to 2 mouthfuls. Unless you'd like to try some of that." He indicated the foul pool.
He left her sitting beside her father and went to where Matatu stood alone at the head of the pool.
"What is it?" he asked.
Matatu shook his head.
"The bull is unhappy. He travels swiftly. He does not feed, and he walks as though the ground burns his feet."
"Why is that, Matatu?"
I do not know."
A little before noon, the spoor changed direction and ran due east.
"We've gained an hour on him," Sean said to Capo. "But he's spooky and tense. And now he's heading straight for the Mozambique border. If he crosses, we've lost him."
Sean considered running the spoor. In the old days of the Bush War, he and Job never walked in pursuit of the enemy. Running, they had been able to cover 60 or 70 miles in a single day. He glanced at Claudia. She moved like an athlete. Then he looked at Ricardo and abandoned the idea. Ricardo was only a year or two short of 60, and he was showing signs of distress, his eyes sunken in plum-coloured hollows, and a greyish cast to his skin. In 3 hours, the trail led them up the side of a low tableland, along an ancient elephant trail that was well-trodden into the iron-hard earth. When they came out on top of the flat plateau, they felt the stir of the evening breeze, and Sean held his sweaty face up to it. The plateau was less than a mile wide. They crossed it quickly and looked down into a shallow valley with another forested tableland beyond. A riverbed meandered down the center of the valley, its course marked with a narrow ribbon of dark green riverine bush, and the rest of the valley fairly open. Sean surveyed it all swiftly, and they went on down the slope. The old bull had settled into that swinging stride that ate up the ground at a prodigious rate. He was boring away towards the border, and the day was wasting, the sun casting their own long shadows ahead of them. Sean was about to give orders to halt when Job whistled softly and made a cutout signal with his left hand. Matatu shook his head in agreement, and the three of them stood looking along the faint spoor.
"Mozambique," Job said. "He has gone away."
And the others did not deny it. Matatu spat.
"Ah, we will not see Tukutela again this year."
Sean turned back. He had wanted that elephant. He had wanted him with the utmost parts of his being. Now, as the disappointment weighed down his legs and his heart, he went heavily to Ricardo.
"He's gone, Capo, across the border."
Ricardo sagged down on the grass in silence. It was 4 o'clock in the morning when they climbed wearily into the truck, and Sean turned and headed towards camp. They drove in silence for a while, with Claudia asleep on her father's shoulder. Then Ricardo asked thoughtfully,
"Do you know where Tukutela has gone? He must have an established range."
Sean nodded.
We reckon that he hulls up from July to September in the swamps below the Kabora Bassa Dam. Then, in late September, he crosses the Zambezi and heads north into Malawi. He stays there until after the rains break, and then comes south again, crosses the Zambezi near Titi, and goes back into the Chiwewe National Park again. We'll get another crack at him next season, Capo.
They reached camp at dawn, and there were steaming hot showers ready for them, and a huge spread in the dining tent. Sean loaded crispy bacon and fried eggs onto their plates.
"I want Tukutela," Ricardo said. "What if we crossed the border and followed him into the swamps?"
Sean studied his face.
"My God, you're serious."
"I told you, there is nothing I want more in this life than that elephant."
"So you expect Job and Matatu and me to commit suicide for a whim of yours?"
"No, I don't expect it for a whim. Let's say for $500,000. Think about it."
Sean jumped up from the breakfast table so violently that he knocked his plate to the ground. He strode away down the path to Job's tent. Job was eating at his own campfire, served by his youngest wife. He gave her a quiet order to leave when he saw Sean coming. Then he took the coffee pot off the coals and poured a second mug. Sean spoke in Sendebele.
"What would you think of a man who followed a great elephant like Tukutela into the swamps along the Zambezi?" "A man of such stupidity does not bear thinking of. Job, old friend, I give you something else to think on. Montero wants to follow the elephant. He's offering $500,000. What do you think of $500,000? Job sighed. "When do we leave?"
"It's my $500,000 you're so gaily throwing around," Claudia told her father. "My inheritance," she explained sweetly. "The very least you can do is let me enjoy it with you now."
Ricardo chuckled. "According to the last audit, young lady, you'll have a little over $36 million coming to you after taxes. But you're not coming into Mozambique with us."
Claudia drew a deep breath. "I don't want to do this, Papa, but I've begun to understand what this means to you. And if I can't go with you, as is my right and my duty, then I will prevent you from going."
He chuckled. "How can you stop me, little girl?"
"I can tell Sean Courtney what Dr. Andrews told me."
Ricardo Montero came to his feet in one lithe, swift movement.
"What did Andrews tell you?"
"He told me that last November
You had a little black spot on your right arm. It had a pretty name. Melanoma, like a girl's name. But it wasn't pretty at all, and you left it too late. He cut it out, but the pathologist said 6 months to a year, Papa. That's what he told me.
Ricardo Montero sat down, and his voice was weary.
When did he tell you?
6 weeks ago. That is why I agreed to come to Africa with you. I don't want to be apart from you for one day of the time we have left. That is why I'm coming with you into Mozambique.
No,
he shook his head. I can't let you. Then I will tell Sean that at any moment it may reach your brain.
She did not have to elaborate. If it affected the brain or nervous system, it would be either general paralysis or total derangement.
I can't let you die alone.
She lapsed into silence as Sean entered the tent.
Capo, Sean said. Across there, it will be Vietnam all over again. But this time without the backup of the U.S. Army. Do you understand that? I want to go,
Capo nodded.
All right. Here are my terms. You will sign an indemnity for whatever happens to you. I am not responsible. And I want a written acknowledgement of debt for the full amount, binding on your estate in the event of your death. Give me the paper.
You are crazy, Capo. Do you know that?
Sure, Ricardo grinned. What about you? Oh, I was born crazy.
Sean laughed with him as they shook hands, and then he sobered.
We'll cross tonight. I want to be in and out in under 10 days.
Ricardo nodded, and Sean told him, get some rest now. You're gonna need it. As Sean turned away, Ricardo said quietly,
Claudia is coming.
No!
Sean let out a bellow. No bloody fear! Capo, it's impossible. It's war out there. I can't take her.
Can you imagine what would happen to her if she were caught by a gang of Renamo cutthroats?
He saw Ricardo flinch, but before he could weaken, Claudia spoke up firmly.
Either I go or nobody goes, and you can kiss your 500,000 goodbye.
She had him, and they both knew it. Sean stared coldly at Claudia.
Okay, cut your own throat, but don't come to me for a bandage.
The poaching expedition would consist of the three whites, Job, Matatu, Pumula, and Dedan.
It's too many, but each of those tusks weighs 130 pounds, Sean explained. We need four big men to bring them back.
Before the equipment was loaded, Sean pared it down to the barest essentials, and the packs were carefully weighed. Sean, Job, Pumula, and Dedan carried 60 pounds each, Ricardo and Matatu 40, while Claudia was down to 25 pounds.
I can carry more, she protested,
but Sean had already turned away. There were still 4 hours of daylight remaining when they left Chiwewe camp. As he drove, Sean spoke in a tightly controlled voice.
Before we commence this guided tour of the Mozambican paradise of the proletariat, will you bear with me while I give you a few facts and figures? Until 1975, Mozambique had been a Portuguese colony for almost 500 years, a reasonably happy and prosperous community of some 15 million souls. Since the Portuguese withdrawal, they've had an economy which has resulted in a negative growth rate of up to 10% per annum, a foreign debt amounting to double the gross national product, and a total breakdown in the educational system. There's one doctor per 45,000 persons. Only 1 person in 10 has access to purified drinking water, and infant mortality is at 340 per 1,000 births. Then there's the Civil War and AIDS.
The Portuguese handed over to Samora Machel and his Frelimo party. Machel, before he and the Russian crew of his Tupolev jet flew into a mountain, was a Marxist. He didn't believe in the nonsense of elections, and his rule was directly responsible for the present condition of the country,
and for the emergence of the National Mozambican Resistance, RENAMO. It controls most of the country, especially the north, and is made up of a pretty ruthless bunch of characters. RENAMO is a South African front organization, directed, supplied, and controlled from Pretoria. Claudia helped him out, committed to the overthrow of a sovereign government.
Ducky, Sean grinned. Just hope we aren't going to meet the lads from either Frelimo or RENAMO. They both shoot the same bullets.
Sean drove on in a silence that gripped them all. The closer they came to the border, the deeper the silence became. At last, Sean turned and looked over his shoulder. Job nodded in agreement.
This is it, ladies and gentlemen, Sean said quietly. All change.
He let the Toyota trundle to a halt where the track crossed a stony ridge.
Where are we? Ricardo asked.
As close as we can safely get to the border, about 3 miles.
Ricardo swung one leg out of the truck, but Sean said sharply,
Hold it, Kepa. Step onto that slab of rock. Leave no tracks.
One at a time, each carrying their own pack, they alighted from the truck, at Sean's instruction stepping precisely in the footsteps of the person in front. Matatu was the last off, and he came backwards, brushing over the sign with a switch of dried grass. The chef had come with them to drive the truck back to the camp.
Go in peace, Mambo,
he called to Sean as he pulled away.
Fat hope,
Sean laughed and sent him off with a wave.
Then to Job, anti-tracking. Let's go.
The formation for anti-tracking was Indian file, Job leading and everyone else stepping in his footprints. Behind them all, Matatu was covering the sign, replacing a pebble lichen side up, stroking a blade of grass into its original position, flicking at the earth with his grass switch. Yet they moved surprisingly fast, so that within half an hour, Claudia felt the chill of fresh sweat between her shoulder blades. Job led them to the top of a low kopje, and Sean motioned them to conceal themselves below the skyline with the sunset behind them. Watching them work, Ricardo remarked softly,
Pumula and Dead Anne seem to know what they're doing.
The two of them had moved out to guard the flanks without being ordered to do so.
Yes.
Sean settled down between him and Claudia.
They were both non-coms in the scouts. They've done this before.
Why are we stopping here?
Claudia asked.
We are sitting on the border, Sean explained, and we'll spend the last of the daylight studying the ground ahead. You can relax until the moon comes up.
He lifted his binoculars, and his concentration on the terrain ahead was absolute, and ended only when the last gleam of the sunset faded. Then he turned to her.
Time for your makeup.
She felt the greasy touch of camouflage cream on her cheek, and instinctively pulled away.
Hold still, he snapped. Your white face shines like a mirror.
He daubed her face and the backs of her hands.
Here comes the moon.
Sean finished working on his own camouflage.
We can go on now.
They went on in silence, an hour and then another hour without pausing. Claudia never knew the exact moment when she crossed the border. Gradually, the silence and the moonlight gave the march a dreamlike unreality, and she found herself mesmerized by it, so that when Sean stopped abruptly, she bumped into him. He whipped a hard, muscular arm around her and held her. They stood frozen, listening, staring into the dark forest. After almost 5 minutes, out on the right flank, Job gave a bird call, and noiselessly, Sean sank to the ground, drawing Claudia down with him. Another soft bird call from the darkness, and Sean put his lips to her ear.
Stay, he breathed.
She felt lonely and exposed as he released her, and disappeared like a ghost into the forest. Sean had been gone for almost an hour, and though her father was close beside her, Claudia was afraid. Then suddenly, Sean was back.
Small party of armed men camped up ahead, Sean was explaining, not more than 20. We don't know who the hell they are, but we can circle around them and keep going, or we can turn back. It's up to you, Capo.
I want that elephant, Ricardo said. You're wasting time.
For 5 hours they circled around the camp, and then Claudia realized they had not turned nor paused for a long while and were once again heading in a straight line. Obviously, they were clear of danger for the moment. With the excitement over, Claudia soon felt the weight of her legs and her weariness. "When will we rest?" she wondered, but made it a point of honor to keep close behind Sean. Almost as though a refrigerator door had opened, the temperature plunged, and she shivered in real discomfort, but did not slacken her pace as she reached back and unstrapped her Gore-Tex ski jacket from the top of her pack. Quite suddenly, she realized that she could see clearly each thick, glossy tress of hair down the back of Sean's neck. "Darn, I thought it would never come." And as she thought it, Sean stopped at last. She pulled up beside him with the nerves in her legs jumping and trembling with fatigue.
"Sorry, Capo," Sean spoke softly past her. "We had to get well clear of that bunch before light. How are you making out?"
"No problem," Ricardo muttered. But in the grey dawn light, his face looked pale and drawn. He went to find a place to sit. Sean glanced at Claudia, still standing beside him. He had a faint, enigmatic smile on his lips. "Don't ask me how I feel," she thought. He inclined his head slightly. Condescension or respect, she wasn't sure.
"First day and the third day are always the worst," he said.
"I feel fine," she said. "I can go on quite happily."
"Sure," he grinned openly. "But you'd better go and look after Papa."
Sean brought mugs of tea to where she sat beside her father, wrapped in her lightweight, down-filled sleeping bag against the dawn chill. Job had brewed on a tiny smokeless fire, and the tea was strong and sweet and scalding. She had never tasted anything more welcome. With it, he handed her a stack of maize cakes and cold cuts of venison. She tried not to wolf them.
"We'll move on in a few minutes," he warned her.
When he saw the dismay in her eyes, he explained,
"We never sleep next to a cooking fire. It can attract the uglies."
They went on 5 miles, and in the middle of the morning, on higher ground, in a place secure and easily defended, Sean showed her how to scoop a hollow for her hip and use her pack as a pillow. She fell asleep as though she had been sandbagged. She could not believe it when he shook her awake only a minute later.
"It's 4 o'clock.
He handed her a mug and another stack of maize cakes. "We're moving out in 5 minutes." With short breaks every 2 hours, they kept going all that night, and Claudia kept her place in the line without lagging. In the dawn, they drank tea. "That's the only thing keeping me going," she confided to her father, only half joking as Sean came across from where he had been in deep discussion with Matatu and Job.
"I'd like to go on for a few hours. Matatu believes he may find the spore."
Sean looked pointedly at Claudia.
"But of course, some of us are a little bushed."
"I need a little stroll to settle my breakfast," she said amiably. But she wished her face was not coated with black cream. She hated conceding even the slightest advantage to him.
"Don't fall for him, Tesoro,"
her father said as Sean walked away.
"He'd be too big a handful, even for you."
She stared at him, outraged.
"Are you out of your skull, Papa? I can't stand the sight of him. But I could cope with him and 5 others like him with my eyes closed and 1 hand tied behind my back. I've got better taste."
"Which is fortunate for you," he murmured.
A little before noon that day, Matatu led them into a papyrus bed which surrounded a green pool, and he led them directly to a great dished spore in the mud. They gathered round to inspect it.
"See,"
Matatu told them,
"this is where Tukatela stood."
And he pointed.
"Then he went away with all his speed."
"He won't stop now until he's into the swamps."
Sean was squatting beside the spore.
"How far?"
Ricardo asked. Sean stood up and studied him.
80 or 90 miles, Kepa. "Just a stroll. But we'll eat and sleep here. Move on again at 4.
He led them onto firm, dry ground, and soon
They were sprawled in the shade,
like dead men.
The heat was fierce and became fiercer still as they reached the rim of the escarpment of the Zambezi Valley and started down. The air lay on the earth in silvery streams like water. It quivered and shimmered and changed the form and shape of things at a distance, so they doubled in size, assuming monstrous shapes in the mirage, or disappeared, swallowed up by the cascades of heated air. As each long mile fell behind them, so vistas of the valley floor opened ahead, and on the horizon they could at last make out the dark belt of riverine vegetation which marked the course of the great Zambezi. Always, Matatu danced along ahead of them like a wraith, following the trail, tireless and unaffected by the heat.
"There is no sign of game," Ricardo remarked. "We haven't seen so much as a rabbit since we crossed into Mozambique."
"This was once a paradise of big game," Sean said. "I hunted here before the Portuguese pulled out, and the buffalo were running in herds, 10,000 strong. But Frelimo fed the army with them, machine-gunned them from helicopters. When the buffalo were finished, they started on the other game, the wildebeest and the zebra."
Sean called a halt an hour before dark for their frugal evening meal.
"Have you got a couple of aspirin?" Ricardo asked.
Sean opened the side flap of his pack and shook three tablets from their bottle.
"Headache?"
Ricardo nodded as he washed them down with a swallow of tea.
"Ah, the dust and sun glare," he explained.
Sean went across to the cooking fire and squatted beside Job.
"Papa." Claudia moved a little closer to her father and touched his arm. "It started, hasn't it?"
"No,"
he replied, too swiftly. "Doc Andrews said there might be headaches."
"Ah, it's the sun. Don't worry about me, Tesoro."
In the morning, Sean marched beside Ricardo. They were on the valley floor now, and far ahead of them, a standing cloud of evaporation marked the position of the swamps. Claudia was still going surprisingly well, but within an hour, Ricardo was flagging, and Sean noticed a disconcerting unsteadiness in his gait.
"Have you got a couple more aspirins for me?" Ricardo mumbled.
"You all right, Capo?"
Sean asked as he handed him the tablets.
"The damned headache again. That's all."
But he would not meet Sean's eyes. The long, tortuous miles fell slowly behind them, and by the time they lay down to sleep that night, the brilliant southern stars burned over their heads. At dawn, they marched into a changed landscape. These were ancient floodplains that were inundated when the great Zambezi broke its banks during the torrential rainy season. They were dry now, and as they moved out into the open, the dried mud cracked into bricklets beneath their feet. When the breeze switched fitfully, they could smell the swamps, still out of view ahead. Out on the plain, Sean felt exposed and vulnerable, and he wanted to hurry. But then he glanced at Ricardo and knew he could not increase the pace. He shaded his eyes against the glare, and far ahead he saw a line of trees drawn like a pencil along the horizon. With relief, Sean followed the spoor of the old bull off the plain and into the trees. This finger of high ground formed an isthmus, a natural causeway from the edge of plains to the beginning of the swamps. The spoor headed down the isthmus, and the old bull had fed quietly as he moved along it. Directly ahead of them stood a gigantic baobab tree, its bark as grey and folded as the old bull's hide. Sean had left Ricardo's side and moved up to Matatu, but before he could speak he heard a strange guttural cry behind him, and he whirled round. Ricardo's face was swollen and congested with blood, and his eyes seemed to start from their sockets. He was pointing ahead, his hand shaking.
"There he is!" he croaked. "For God's sake! Can't you see him?"
Sean whirled and followed the direction of his outstretched arm.
"What is it, man?"
He was looking ahead and did not see Ricardo turn to Pumula and snatch the Rigby rifle, but he heard the metallic clash of the bolt as Ricardo chambered a cartridge.
"Capo, what the hell are you doing?"
Sean was sprinting to catch him.
"Don't!"
But the Rigby crashed out, and the echoes of the shot rolled across the plains. Sean seized the rifle and wrested it out of Ricardo's grip.
In the name of all that's holy, man, what on earth do you think you're doing? Have you gone crazy?
Tuco Taylor,
Ricardo mouthed.
Don't you see him?
He was shaking like a man with fever. You're shooting at a tree. Sean roughly turned him to face the baobab.
Look at it, you bloody madman. There's your elephant.
Claudia ran forward. Leave him alone. Can't you see he's sick?
He's gone crazy. He's calling up every Frelimo and Renamo thug within 50 miles.
Leave him. Sean let go of her father and stepped back.
All right. He's all yours.
Claudia embraced her father.
It's all right, Papa. It's all right.
Ricardo was staring at the deep, raw wound in the bark of the baobab from which sap was oozing.
I thought it was...
He shook his head weakly.
Why did I do that? I thought... Poor Papa.
Claudia was hugging him.
Don't upset yourself.
Sean looked back the way they had come.
Job, what chance the uglies heard?
We'll find out the hard way, Sean.
We'll have to rest here. The Mambo is sick. Brew a billy of tea, he ordered.
He walked back to where Claudia was still holding her father.
Sorry I pushed you around, Capo, Sean said mildly. You gave me a hell of a fright. I think you've got a touch of the sun, so let's get you into the shade.
Ricardo leaned back against the bole of the baobab and closed his eyes. He looked pale and bewildered. Sean jerked his head in a peremptory gesture at Claudia, and she followed him.
This doesn't come as any surprise to you, does it?
He accused as soon as they were beyond earshot.
Just what kind of a daughter are you? You knew he was sick, and you let him come on this jaunt.
Her tears took him by surprise.
He's not sick, Sean. He's dying. Cancer. I was diagnosed by a specialist before we left home. He predicted that it could attack the brain like this, that there might be hallucinations.
Sean's fury crumpled.
No, he said. Not Capo. Why do you think I insisted on coming with him? I knew this was his last hunt, and I wanted to be with him.
They were silent, staring at each other. Then she said,
You care. I can see that you truly care for him. I didn't expect that.
He's my friend, Sean said.
I didn't think you were capable of gentleness, she went on softly. I may have misjudged you.
Perhaps we misjudged each other, he said. But we haven't settled anything. We haven't decided what we're going to do.
We go on, of course, she answered, right to the bitter end. That's what I promised him.
The mug of tea and a half dozen anodyne revived Ricardo. He was acting and talking completely rationally again, and none of them made any further reference to his wild behavior. They followed the ridge of high ground until there was a gap in the trees, and Sean stopped.
There they are, he said. The Zambezi swamplands.
The reed beds seemed limitless, but Sean had flown over them, and he knew that they were interspersed with shallow lagoons of open water and narrow winding channels.
Nobody can follow a trail in there.
Ricardo stood where dry, friable earth ended and damp swamp mud began, staring at the wall of swamp growth higher than his head.
Nobody, Sean agreed, except Matatu.
They were standing in the remains of a village. Clearly the previous occupants had been fishermen, but their huts had been burned to the ground. Job whistled for Sean. He was standing over an object which lay in the short grass. At first Sean thought it was a bundle of rags, and then he saw the bones protruding from it.
When?
Sean asked.
6 months ago. Bullet through the back of the head,
Job said, and walked deeper into the grass.
Here's another.
Renamo has been through here, Sean gave his opinion.
Or it was Frelimo looking for Renamo rebels, and they decided to question them with an AK.
Poor buggers, Sean said. They get it from both sides. Search the edge of the papyrus beds for their canoes. Claudia screamed, and they all spun to face the sound. She screamed again, the sound strangely muffled, and Sean began to run.
Claudia,
he yelled,
where are you?
The pitfall had been dug for trapping a hippopotamus. It was 10 feet deep, with funnel-shaped sides that would tumble one of the huge beasts down into its depths and wedge it securely between the earthen walls. The opening was covered by branches strong enough to carry the weight of a man, but not hippo. Over these branches, the builders had spread papyrus stems. However, the pitfall had been built a long time previously, and the branches had rotted. Claudia had landed awkwardly with one leg twisted up under her. She sat up, clutching her injured knee to her chest and gasping wildly to fill her agonized lungs.
Are you all right?
Sean peered down anxiously.
I think so, she gasped. Just looking for the little girl's room.
She tried to stand, but the pain shot through her knee.
My knee, she said.
They lifted her out of the pit with a loop of rope under her armpits, and as soon as she was on level ground, Sean made a thorough examination of her knee. Already it was ballooning.
Okay, he nodded. It's the medial ligament. I think you've just sprained it.
What does that mean?
3 days, he replied, before you're walking.
He carried her back to the village and strapped the knee with an elastic bandage from his first aid kit.
That's all we can do for it, he told her. The only question now is what on earth we're going to do with you.
Leave me here,
she said promptly.
Are you out of your mind? He asked,
and Ricardo backed him up immediately.
Out of the question.
Papa, you can't carry me. I can't walk.
So you leave someone to look after me while you go on after Tuca Taylor?
No.
Ricardo shook his head. Sean stared at her, and the admiration she saw in his gaze gave her a full, warm feeling.
Sean, we know how much that elephant means to Papa. I want it as my special gift to him. Make him go. Tell him I'll be as safe here with Job to look after me as I would be in the swamp with you.
It's not my business, Sean said. It's between the two of you.
Will you leave us alone, Sean?
Claudia asked. He stood up and walked away, leaving them together in the gathering darkness. He heard a shout from the papyrus bed, and he headed down to the water's edge.
What is it, Job?
There were confused shouts and splashing. Then Job and Matatu emerged, dragging something long and black between them. Sean grinned.
Our first bit of luck!
It was a traditional Makoro dugout canoe, about 17 feet long and hewn from a single log. The body, just wide enough for a person to sit in, was sound. An hour passed before Ricardo came to them.
All right, Sean. His voice was drawn.
We do as she wants.
Working in the moonlight, they built a fly camp a few hundred meters back in the forest. They made a lean-to shelter for Claudia, and Sean left the medical kit and most of their remaining provisions with her. He detailed Job and Dedan to remain. Job would keep the light 30-60 rifle.
Send Dedan back to keep an eye on the isthmus. Any Frelimo or Renamo will come that way. At the first sign of trouble, get the girl into the swamp and hide out on one of the islands.
Sean turned to where Ricardo was taking leave of his daughter.
Are you ready, Capo?
Ricardo stood up quickly and walked away from Claudia without looking back.
Don't get into any more trouble, Sean told her.
You neither. She looked up at him. And Sean, take care of Papa for me.
Within seconds of pushing off, they were surrounded by a high palisade of papyrus, and their view was restricted to the wall of reeds and the small patch of lemon-yellow dawn sky overhead. The night's clammy chill hung over the swamp, and when they came out suddenly into an open lagoon, there was a heavy mist lying over the surface, and a flock of whistling duck alarmed the dawn with the clatter of their wings. The sun rose above the papyrus. The mist twisted into rising tendrils and was gone. The heat built up swiftly.
At places, the water was only a few inches deep, and they were forced to climb out and drag the dugout through to the next channel or lagoon. Under the matted reeds, the mud was black and foul-smelling and reached to their knees. There was only room for Ricardo to stretch out in the bottom of the dugout when they slept that night, while the others took what rest the clouds of mosquitoes allowed them. Early the following morning, Sean set the end of the punt pole in the mud and steadied it, while Matatu shinned up it like a monkey and peered ahead. When he came down, he told Sean,
"I can see the islands at the edge of the main channel. We will be there before noon, and unless Tukutela has heard us, he will be on one of the islands."
They went on, dragging the dugout through the shallows, until abruptly the water deepened, and Pamula poled them through to the first island. The earth was grey and sandy, but it was good to have dry land underfoot. Matatu slipped away to make a circuit of the island, and the water had just boiled in the billy when he was back.
"Yes," he nodded at Sean, "he passed here yesterday. Early. He left at sunrise."
"Which way?" Sean asked.
Matatu pointed.
"There is another larger island close by."
While they loaded the dugout, Sean gulped a mug of the scalding tea and kicked sand over the fire. They punted and pushed the canoe across the channel to the next island, and Matatu scurried into the dense undergrowth to pick up the elephant's spoor again. He was back within 15 minutes.
"He has moved on," Matatu whispered.
On the next island, they found where Tukutela had left the water to go ashore, and the mud he had smeared on the brush as he passed was still damp. Matatu shivered with excitement.
"Close! Very close!" he whispered excitedly.
Ricardo grinned with excitement as they crept forward in single file. Then they heard it. The low rumble like summer thunder heard at a distance. The sound that an elephant makes when he is content and at peace. Sean laid his hand on Ricardo's arm and drew him gently up alongside him.
"We have to be careful of the wind," he began in a whisper.
And then they heard the swish and rush of water sucked up in the bull's trunk and squirted back over his own shoulders.
"Back off."
He made a cutout signal. Matatu obeyed instantly. Sean led Ricardo back by the arm, stopping below the outspread branches of a tall strangler fig.
"Let's take a look," he ordered.
They propped their rifles at the base of the trunk and climbed upwards. Near the top of the fig, they found a secure stance and stared down into the papyrus beds. They saw him immediately. Tukutela's back rose above the reeds. It was wet and charcoal black, his huge ears flapping lazily. It seemed that they had waited their lifetimes for this moment. The hunter's passion eclipsed all other emotion. Here was something primeval, sprung from the very wells of the soul, and it affected them as great music might affect others. At that moment, there was nothing else in their universe.
"He's beautiful," Ricardo whispered.
They watched the old bull heave his body from the reeds, climb the low bank and stand for a moment, tall and gaunt and shining wet in the sun, before he pushed his way into the undergrowth, and it swallowed up even his bulk. They went down quickly and moved forward, forced to move in single file, following the path that the bull had opened through the otherwise impenetrable growth. Suddenly, there was a loud crackling uproar in the bushes just ahead of them, and they saw the branches sway and toss and shake. Ricardo swung up the Rigby, but Sean grabbed his arm. The old bull was feeding. Only 30 paces from them, he was ripping down branches, rumbling contentedly, and they could not catch even the barest glimpse of grey hide. Sean still had hold of Ricardo's arm, and now he drew him onwards, step by step, through the green press of leaves and drooping branches. 10 paces, and then Sean halted. He eased Ricardo forward, pushing him ahead, and Sean pointed over his shoulder. For long seconds, Ricardo could make out no details in the jumbled growth and confused shadows. Then the bull flapped his ears again, and Ricardo saw his eye through a hole in the vegetation.
It was a small, roomy eye, and tears oozed down the wrinkled cheek below it, giving it a look of great wisdom and infinite sorrow. The sorrow was contagious. It engulfed Ricardo in a black wave, transforming his ardent, predatory passion to a devastating sadness and mourning for this life he was about to end. He did not lift the rifle. The elephant's eye looked deep into Ricardo's own, seemed to pierce his very soul, seemed to mourn for him as he mourned for the old bull. Ricardo felt Sean tap him lightly between the shoulder blades, screening even that tiny movement from the bull. It was the urgent command to fire. But Ricardo was looking upon himself, watching both the man and the beast, with death in them, and death all about them. And the tragedy engrossed him, and robbed him of his will. The elephant was 15 paces away, standing perfectly still, a looming grey shadow in the undergrowth. Sean knew that Tukutela's sudden stillness was the old bull's response to danger, and he wanted to seize Ricardo's shoulder and shake him. He wanted to cry out, "Shoot, man! Shoot!" But he was helpless. The slightest movement would trigger the old bull. Then Ricardo called loudly, "Tukutela, we are brothers. Our destiny is linked. I cannot kill you." The bull squealed, a sound so loud and pitched so high that it was like an auger driven into their eardrums, and Tukutela, the angry one, charged the sound of the human voice like an avalanche of grey rock. Filled with remorse and bitter despair, Ricardo let the Rigby slip from his hands and staggered blindly to meet the elephant, wanting in some way to make recompense to the great beast. Ricardo saw Tukutela's vast grey head burst out of the green forest wall above him, and the long, stained tusks came over him, a benediction that would absolve him and redeem all the blood he had spilled. He reached up both hands to them joyfully and thankfully.
"Forgive me, Father, for I have sinned," he cried.
Sean saw the bull's head rear out of the thicket. He heard Ricardo's voice, though he could not understand the words, and he threw up his rifle. The bullet cleaved the old bull's brain, and his legs collapsed under him. He dropped on his chest with an impact that jarred the earth, and his right tusk drove into Ricardo Montero's body, entering his belly and coming out through his spine. The shaft of ivory, which Ricardo had coveted, now pinned him to the earth. There was no pain, no sensation in his lower body, which was twisted under the bull's coiled trunk. No pain even in his head. He saw Sean Courtney's face floating before him, and heard his voice fading away.
"Capo! Capo! Capo!"
And Ricardo Montero made a huge effort and said,
"She loves you. Look after my little girl."
Then the darkness swallowed him. Sean's first impulse was to free Ricardo Montero's body, but after piercing Ricardo, the ivory point had gone on to bury itself deep in the soft, sandy earth. It would take half a day's work to free the body. In death, the man and the beast were locked together, and suddenly Sean realized how appropriate that was. He would leave them like that. He turned to where Matatu and Pumulu stood, staring in awe at the grim spectacle.
"Go," Sean ordered. "Wait for me at the canoe."
Ricardo's eyes were wide open. Sean closed them with a gentle stroke of his thumb.
"It happened at just the right time, Capo. And it was a fitting end for a man like you. I'm glad you didn't die between soiled sheets. I pray that I will be as fortunate."
Sean stroked a tusk. It had the texture of precious jade beneath his fingertips.
"We'll leave them for you, Capo," he said. "These tusks will be your headstone."
He replaced the Rigby in the crook of Ricardo's right arm. A warrior should be buried with his weapons, he murmured. Go in peace, old friend. The reeds scraped softly along the hull of the canoe as Pamula poled it along. None of them spoke. Sean sat amidships, hunched forward. He felt emptied of all emotion except sadness. He looked up at the sky. The sun had set. Even as he watched, Venus appeared, with a miraculous suddenness, low down in the west. He thought about Claudia, and while he felt that Capo had been raving when he'd said Claudia loved him, he realized with a small shock that her image was so clear in his mind that he could almost count the tiny laughter lines at the corners of her mouth, and he wanted to be with her. I must have been crazy to leave her alone, he thought. He felt the canoe check under him as Pamula rested on his pole, ready to stop for the night. I'll take her, Sean said. We'll keep going until we get back to the village. While Pamula and Matatu curled up in the bilges, Sean stood in the stern and steered by the cross and the pointers. The papyrus stems hissed softly against the hull in rhythm to his thrusts, and his eagerness to be with her kept him going long after fatigue demanded a halt. It was early afternoon before Sean leapt onto dry land and strode through the ruins of the village. Job should have kept a better watch, he thought angrily, if we can arrive unseen. He did not finish the thought. Just ahead was the thicket in which they had built Claudia's shelter, and Sean stopped abruptly. Something was wrong. He went down fast and hard, rolling quickly into cover with the .577 held in front of him. He lay and listened. The silence was a physical weight. He imitated the clucking sound of a francolin, one of the scouts' assembly calls that Job would recognize. There was no reply. He went forward at a leopard crawl and then stopped. The corpse lay face down under a thorn bush. A black man, the body stripped of clothing and boots. Sean crawled forward until he lay side by side with the body. A single bullet had ploughed out of the man's back, and the flies crawled over the wound. He smelt the whiff of corruption. Dead 24 hours, he estimated, and rose to his knees. No further need for caution now. Job, he called. Claudia! It was a despairing cry, and he ran forward to the lean-to. It was deserted. There was another naked black body lying at the edge of the clearing. A skinny little runt of a man with a top shot of his skull. Two of the bastards, Sean said bitterly. Nice shooting, Job. Matatu was checking the lean-to. He left it and began to work out in circles. Sean and Pamula stood and watched him, not joining his search so they would not trample the signs. Within minutes, Matatu scurried back.
There are 15 of them. They surrounded the hut and came in at a rush. Job shot these two. There was much struggling, but they took them.
The Memsahib?
Sean dreaded the reply.
Ndiyo,
Matatu replied in Swahili.
Yes, they took her also. She was fighting them all the way. Job was hurt and so was Dedan. Perhaps they were beaten, and I think their arms are bound. They walk unsteadily. They stripped their dead of uniforms and boots and banduki, and then went back.
He pointed along the isthmus.
When?
Sean asked.
Yesterday. Early.
Sean nodded grimly.
Let's go.
Within the first mile, they settled into the pursuit pace of a scout raiding party, and Sean dispensed with any precautions against ambush. He relied entirely on Matatu to pick up any sign of booby traps or anti-personnel mines. But apart from that, they went in single file, at a speed not much below that of an Olympic marathon. Claudia's image winged his feet. 15 of them, Matatu had said, and they'd been willing to accept casualties without inflicting them. They had wanted prisoners. Any way he considered it, Claudia was in terrible danger. They must have read the sign going into the village and known that 4 men were missing from the original party, so they anticipated a pursuit. Ahead of him, Matatu checked his run.
Here! Here they rested!
Matatu pointed to where the group had sat in the shade of a grove of young mapani. There were the crushed butts of cigarettes in the dust, and Matatu pointed to the raw white slashes on the mapani, from which branches had been chopped.
They have built a mashela for the mem.
Sean nodded with relief. They had built a litter on which to carry Claudia. That meant they had placed a higher value on her than he dreaded they might. The spoor led them back, retracing their own route across the dry flood plains, heading towards the south. And it was broad and easy to follow, with no attempt at anti-tracking. Matatu reported that they were forcing Dedan and Job to carry the litter. And at pursuit speed, they were rapidly overhauling the clumsy and slow-moving group. Matatu pulled up again.
Ah, they cooked here last night.
He pointed to the remains of a campfire. Sean glanced at his watch. They'd been going just over 3 hours, and they still had plenty of daylight.
All right. We'll drink now, he ordered,
and handed out salt tablets from his pack. They paused for less than 5 minutes.
Let's go, said Sean.
An hour later, they found where the raiders had slept that night.
Search, Sean ordered. Job will have tried to get a message to us.
Nothing,
Matatu reported back a few minutes later, and Sean felt a prick of disappointment.
Where did the Memsahib sleep? Sean demanded.
There,
Matatu pointed. Somebody, probably Job, had cut an armful of leaves and grass for her mattress. Sean squatted and carefully sifted through it. Then he noticed the button, half buried in the dust. An engraved brass button from her jeans.
Designer jeans, that's my ducky.
He gently brushed aside the dust under where the button had lain. A scrap of cardboard. The flap from the lid of a packet of cheap Portuguese cigarillos. She had written with a charcoal stick, scavenged from the fire. 15 Renamo. They expect you. All okay. C.
You little beauty, you, he whispered. You've got to be the brightest, gutsiest.
For the first time, he admitted his longing for her, and then suppressed it firmly as he came to his feet. There was no time for such self-indulgence now.
Renamo, he said. 15 of them. They know we are following.
Within an hour, they came upon the first ambush, cunningly sited on the edge of open ground with a good field of fire. It had been abandoned only a short time before they came up to it. Sean had been pushing too hard. His concern for Claudia had unbalanced his judgment.
Flankers out,
Sean ordered reluctantly.
Ambush precautions.
It would slow them to half their previous speed, and 3 men were too few. It left only Matatu on the spoor. They had a single weapon between them, against trained bushfighters, armed with automatic weapons, and they were expected.
Just another name for suicide, Sean told himself.
But despite the odds, he had to restrain himself from quickening the pace. In the center, Matatu whistled. Sean fell flat and carefully checked his front and flanks before he went to join him. Matatu was squatting beside the trail, his expression worried. He stabbed a finger at the spoor, and Sean saw immediately what was troubling him. The original band of Renamo had been reinforced by an even larger group. At a glance, it looked like a full company of infantry.
How far behind are we? Sean demanded.
Matatu used his forefinger like the hour hand of a clock to indicate a segment of the sky.
3 hours.
When the moon rose that night, it was only a sliver of silver, soon blotted out by cloud. Blundering around in the dark, they would either run on top of the Renamo night guards or would miss them completely. They went into laager for the night, well off the trail, in a thicket of thorn. Sean was sliding into the black hole of exhaustion when Matatu's whisper called him back.
There is one of the new Renamo I have seen before, but it was long ago, and I cannot remember where.
Sean would have had difficulty remembering the faces of every person he had met in, say, the last 10 years. Here was Matatu bemoaning the fact that he could not instantly recognize a single set of footprints, which he had last seen years previously, out of a jumble of other tracks.
Go to sleep, you silly little bugger.
He smiled in the darkness.
Perhaps you'll dream his name in your sleep.
While the sun was still low and the dew was on the grass, they came up to the dry riverbed in which the Renamo had bivouacked for the night. The band could not be far ahead. Matatu hovered over a set of mail tracks. Whoever had made them wore boots with a double herring pattern on the sole.
I know him, Matatu whispered. I know the way this one walks.
They went forward with extreme caution now. The trail led them directly towards the higher ground along the escarpment of the valley, and soon they entered the foothills. In the hills, every boulder, every fold of ground was a possible enemy redoubt, and had to be minutely inspected before they could move on. Shaun fretted with impatience, but forced himself to gear his advance to the difficult terrain. They turned the corner of another low hill, and through a frieze of graceful masasa trees, an open vista stretched ahead to where the massif of the central escarpment rose above its foothills.
There it is, Shaun murmured. That's where they'll be laying for us.
The spur was pointed directly at a pass through the escarpment. The entrance was guarded by cliffs of red stone, and the gut of the pass was almost devoid of trees or cover, and yet the sides were heavily bushed. It was a natural trap, a perfect killing ground. Matatu whistled, and Shaun doubled over, keeping off the crest as he ran down to join him. From the centre, there was an unimpeded view up the gut of the valley, and Shaun saw movement against the scree. He lifted the binoculars, and the line of dark moving specks resolved through into a column of men. Most of them wore tiger-striped camouflage and jungle hats, and the front of the column was already into the bush at least 3 miles distant. Matatu spat.
The valley is the mouth of the crocodile. They want us to put our heads into it.
You are right, Matatu.
He sat down behind the boulder and tried to think it through. Probably the best chance of releasing the captives was diplomatic negotiation through the South African government in Pretoria.
Okay, I have to get a message back to the American embassy in Harare.
Immediately he realized that this took care of his other major worry, Matatu and Pumula. He opened the flap of his backpack and found his notepad. Ricardo had been an important and influential man. In his note, Shaun implied that both father and daughter were captives of Renamo. The U.S. Embassy could be relied on to react swiftly. Shaun tore the pages out of his notepad and folded them.
And I'll follow the column and wait for an opportunity.
He grinned at the absurdity of his decision. What opportunity?
I remember,
Matatu said eagerly.
I remember who he is.
Sidetracked, Shaun frowned at him.
Who are you talking about?
The leader of the Renamo,
Matatu told him happily.
I told you I knew his footprints. Do you remember when we attacked the training camp at Inchlazane? Do you remember how we killed them in the riverbed?
Matatu chuckled with the delightful memory of it.
Do you remember the one we caught while he was trying to burn the camp documents, the one who refused to march, and you blew his ear in, firing your pistol by his head?
Now Matatu giggled at that fine joke.
The blood came out of his ear hole, and he squeaked like a virgin. Then he marched.
Comrade China?
Yes, that is the one.
No. Shaun shook his head. That's not possible.
Now Matatu had to cover his mouth to muffle his delighted squeals of laughter. He loved it when he was able to confound and astound his master. There was no better joke. Shaun stared at him unseeingly while he adjusted his mind to this extraordinary intelligence with its origins back in the bloody days of the Rhodesian War. In the spring of 1976, Shaun had taken the Ballantine scouts nearly 100 miles across the Mozambique border to destroy a major Frelimo guerrilla camp. They had killed at least 1,500 in the riverbed and captured Comrade China, the equivalent of a major general and high on the wanted list of the Rhodesians. Shaun shook his head. Comrade China had been a commissar in Robert Mugabe's Marxist Zanla army, and RENAMO was a rabidly anti-communist organization committed to the overthrow of the Marxist Frelimo government. Furthermore, Comrade China had fought the Rhodesian army of Ian Smith. What was he doing here, across the border, involved in another struggle in a foreign country?
"I'm sending you back to Chiwewe," Sean told Matatu abruptly, and the little man's mirth was instantly extinguished.
Matatu stared at him in disbelief and utter despair. Sean turned to Pumula.
"Take this back to camp. Tell them to radio the message to Miss Rima in our Harare office. Matatu will guide you. Do you understand me?"
"Mambo."
Pumula would obey without argument.
"All right, go," Sean ordered. "Go, now."
Pumula crawled down off the ridge, and once he was clear, jumped to his feet and trotted away. Sean forced himself to look at Matatu.
"Go. Show Pumula the way back to Chiwewe."
Matatu's eyes were tragic, his expression abject. Sean wanted to pick him up and hug him.
"Get the hell out of here," Sean growled at him. "Go."
And the little man accepted the inevitable and slunk away down the slope. Deliberately, Sean turned his back and raised the binoculars to study the escarpment line. The entrance of the valley was as inviting as the mouth of a carnivorous plant to an insect, and the cliffs were forbidding and inaccessible, but Sean concentrated upon them, and he kept coming back to a point, a quarter of a mile to the right of the valley. There was a route that looked as though it might just go, though it wouldn't be easy. As the night spread its cloak, Sean crept up towards the base of the cliff. The bush grew dense and tangled there, and it took him much longer than he had anticipated to reach the rocky wall. Rock climbing had always been one of his passions. However, he had never attempted a climb like this before. He had no ropes, no anchorman, no pitons, no carabiners, and he would be opening this route in darkness. Sean stepped up on the face and began to climb. In places he could not see above his head, and he climbed by instinct, reaching up in the darkness, his fingertips as sensitive as those of a pianist as they brushed the rock, and then locked into it. Without check or pause, he covered the first pitch and reached the ledge 100 feet up from the base. The ledge was no more than 9 inches wide. With the pack strapped on his back and the rifle protruding on each side of his shoulders, he was forced to stand facing the cliff, with his heels hanging over the edge and the weight of his pack pulling on his shoulders, trying to drag him backwards. He was less comfortable on the ledge than he had been on the face, and he began to shuffle along it, spreading his arms like a crucifix to steady himself. He counted his shuffling, crab-like paces along the ledge, and by the time he reached 100, the ledge under his toes had narrowed dangerously, and the muscles in his thighs were burning and quivering. 20 paces more, and the cliff face was beginning to bulge out towards him, forcing him further backwards, and he had to thrust his hips forward to keep himself from toppling out over the sheer drop. The strain on his legs was intolerable now. He wanted to stop, just to rest his legs a moment and gather himself, but he knew that would be the end of it. To stop on a pitch like this was certain death. He made himself take another pace, then another. And suddenly, the fingers of his left hand touched the crack. He thrust his hand into it as deep as it would go, and then bunched his fist, jamming it securely into the crack. Now he could hang back on his arm and rest his back and his aching legs. He could not wait any longer. He had to keep moving. He reached up with his free hand, and hand over hand, foot over foot, he walked up the crack. He could see the top of the cliff now, only 100 feet above his head, and then he felt the crack began to open wider. He groped above his head, searching the depth of the crack for another hold, and he found only smooth sandstone. He turned his body, trying to wedge his shoulder into the crack, but the barrel of the rifle clanged against the face, blocking his turn. He hung there, knowing that he had only a few seconds before his legs gave under him. He understood clearly what he had to do, but it went contrary to all his instincts.
"Do it."
His voice grated in his own ears. Do it, or die. He reached down and opened the quick-release buckle on the waistband of his backpack. Then he straightened one arm and reached backwards and downwards. The carrying strap slid off his shoulder, and the altered weight of the pack slewed his whole body around, so he had to fight to stay on the cliff face. He thrust his hand back into the crack and, gathering all his strength, straightened his other arm behind him. The pack dropped off his back and fell away into the darkness. Relieved of the weight, Sean tottered and swayed, and then grabbed wildly at the crack and managed to hold himself from plunging after his pack into the abyss. He clung to the rock and listened to the pack, striking the cliff as it fell, the steel of his rifle barrel ringing like a bronze bell off the rock, a terrifying sound in the night. Long after the pack and rifle had come to rest at the base of the cliff, the echoes reverberated against the hills. Sean swung himself sideways and was able at last to wedge his shoulder into the crack. He rested like that, panting wildly, the terror of death, for the moment, unnerving him. His pack was gone. The rifle, his water bottles, sleeping bag, food. All gone. He whispered, "We'll worry about that when we get to the top." And he began to climb again. Gradually, the crack became a full chimney, and he could get his whole body into it and double one leg under him to propel himself up more swiftly. At the top, Sean was able to hook both hands over the edge. His fingers gripped, and he kicked both legs and drew himself upwards by the strength of his arms. Then he was on the rock, sobbing softly with exertion. He pushed himself to his feet. He must get off the exposed face of the cliff and into cover. He ran forward, crouching low, and he was halfway to the bush when the light hit him. It stopped him dead, as though he'd run into rock, and he flung up his hands to protect his eyes. The voice that boomed out over the trees was as shocking as a blow in the face.
"Good evening, Colonel Courtney."
Good English, barely touched by an African accent.
"You made excellent time. 27 minutes from the base of the cliff to the top."
Sean absorbed the bitter humiliation of it. They'd been toying with him.
"But I cannot give you high marks for stealth. What was that you threw down the rock? It sounded like old tin pots."
The speaker chuckled sardonically.
"And now, Colonel, would you be good enough to raise both hands above your head?"
He obeyed. Two dark figures detached themselves from the tree line. They closed on either side of him and searched him swiftly, stripping him of his knife belt. Then they backed off, their AKs aimed at his belly. The man that came into the light now was tall and lean, and he moved with a cat-like grace.
"It's been a long time, Colonel Courtney."
"Many years," Sean agreed.
"You'll have to speak up."
The man stopped a few paces in front of Sean and jokingly cupped one hand to the side of his head.
"I'm deaf in one ear, you know," he said.
Sean grinned sardonically at him.
"I should have blown your other ear out while I was about it, Comrade China."
"Yes," China agreed. He smiled. He was a handsome man, a few years younger than Sean, with refined nilotic features. He exuded confidence and purpose.
"However, Colonel, pleasant though it is to renew acquaintance, I cannot afford more time away from my headquarters. There will be an opportunity to talk later, but now I must leave you. My men will take care of you."
He turned and disappeared into the darkness beyond the light. There were 10 men in Sean's guard detail, under the command of a sergeant, picked troops, powerful and lean as a pack of wolves. They closed up around him and urged him to a jog trot, heading southwards into the night. After an hour, the sergeant signaled a pause, and they stopped beside the track. Sean reached across to the nearest guerrilla and tapped the water bottle on his belt. The man spoke to the sergeant in Shangani. Sean spoke it fluently, but he gave no indication of having understood. As the trooper said,
The Mabunu wants to drink.
Give it him, the sergeant said. You know the Inkosi wants him alive.
They ran up the dawn, and Sean expected them to overhaul the main column, but mile succeeded mile without sign of it, nor were its tracks on the footpath. The sergeant had flankers out, sweeping the verges of the footpath ahead for an ambush by Frelimo. But what seemed to concern him more than attack from the forest was the menace from the sky. Whenever they were forced to cross open ground, they stopped and searched the sky, listened for the sound of engines before venturing out, and then they crossed to the new line of trees at a full run. This preoccupation with aerial attack puzzled Sean. All he had heard indicated that Frelimo's air force was so weak as to be almost non-existent. They slept in the afternoon and ran through the night, and when they stopped again to eat, his captors began to discuss him in Shangani through their mouthfuls of maize.
They say that in the other war he was a lion, an eater of men, the sergeant told them. It was he that led the attack at Inchlazane.
The troopers looked at him with respect.
They say that it was veritably he in person who destroyed one ear of General China.
They chuckled. That was a fine joke.
Why has General China ordered this?
Another asked, and the sergeant grinned.
We must run the pride and the anger out of him. General China wants us to change him from a lion into a dog who will wag his tail and do his bidding.
So it's a contest, then. Sean kept his face impassive.
All right, you bastards. Let's see which dog wags its tail first.
Sean began to enjoy himself. There were 10 of them, all in their 20s. He was just over 40 years of age, but that handicap made it even sweeter and helped him to endure the days that followed. He was careful not to let them know that he understood that this was a contest. He showed them just the right degree of respect, but not enough to make them contemptuous. He took especial care not to challenge the sergeant's authority or force him to lose face in front of his men. He made the most of their sense of humor and of fun. With sign language and a little clowning, he made them laugh. And once they had laughed with him, their whole relationship altered subtly. He became more a companion than a captive. Twice they passed burned-out villages, and at their next meal, they discussed his performance to date, agreeing that he was acquitting himself admirably.
But, the sergeant asked, he can run, and we know he can kill men. But can he kill a henshaw?
Henshaw was the Shangani word for a falcon, and Sean had heard them use it many times over the last 5 days. Each time, they looked up at the sky with a troubled expression.
General China thinks so, the sergeant went on. But who knows?
On the next stage, Sean began to force the pace. Instead of keeping his station 2 paces behind the sergeant who led the column, he closed up until he was running on his heels. Instinctively, the sergeant lengthened his own stride, and Sean matched him, keeping close, pushing him. The sergeant glanced over his shoulder irritably, and Sean grinned at him. The sergeant's eyes narrowed, then he grinned back and extended his stride into a full run.
That's it, my friend, Sean said, and they went away at a killing pace.
Within an hour, there were only 3 of them left, and ahead of them, the path climbed a steep incline to the crest of another tableland. Sean moved up slightly until he was running shoulder to shoulder with the sergeant. But when he tried to pull ahead, the man kept with him. They ran at the top of their speed now, and the third man dropped out. They ran grimly, in a wash of sweat, their breathing harsh. And Sean came out on the crest 3 feet in front of the sergeant, and threw himself down on the hard earth and rolled onto his back, moaning for breath. The sergeant dropped beside him with his breath sobbing in his chest. After a minute, Sean sat up and they stared at each other. Then Sean began to laugh, a harsh, painful cackle. But the Shangani laughed with him, though clearly each gust of laughter was an agony. When the march resumed an hour later, the sergeant left the endless footpath and struck across country to the west. The trial was over. Before dark, they ran into a Renamo line of permanent defences. They were entrenched along the bank of a wide but sluggish river. The dugouts and trenches were covered with logs and sandbags and meticulously camouflaged against aerial discovery. There were mortars and heavy machine guns dug in, with commanding fields of fire across the river. Once they'd crossed the river and been passed through the defences, Sean's appearance created a stir of interest. Off-duty troopers turned out and crowded around them. His captors were clearly enjoying the elevated status that a white prisoner bestowed upon them. Their route was still south and west, and as they ran, they saw many more fortifications and strong points. Sean saw light field artillery in bagged emplacements, together with mortars in their redoubts and detachments armed with RPG rockets. All the troops he saw seemed to be cheerful and of high morale, well-fed and equipped. His escort had replenished their packs from the garrison stores. When they stopped to eat, the May's meal was in 2 kilo paper sacks marked Premier Mills and Made in South Africa. They passed what were obviously training areas where fresh-faced black recruits, both male and female, some of them in their early teens, sat in rows under thatched sun shelters, like schoolchildren in a classroom. Beyond the rear training area, they entered what appeared to be a series of low, sparsely manned kopjes. It was only when they were within a few metres of the side of one of these hills that Sean spotted the entrances to the dugouts. They would be invisible from the air, and Sean could tell by the changed deportment of his guards that they had reached headquarters. Without ceremony, they turned aside and drew up at the entrance to one of the underground bunkers. The sergeant handed Sean over to the guards at the entrance, and he was hustled down the steps into the subterranean maze hacked out of the earth. He was hurried down a passageway, at the end of which there was a curtained-off doorway. His escort called a respectful request to enter, and the reply was authoritative. Sean pushed the curtain aside and stepped into the room.
"Comrade China," Sean smiled. "What a pleasant surprise. That form of address is no longer appropriate, Colonel Courtney. In future, please address me as General China, or simply as Sir."
He sat at a desk, dressed in battle dress that was adorned with silver paratrooper wings and 4 rows of gaudy ribbons. The butt of the automatic pistol in his holster was ivory-handled. General China was taking his conversion from Marxism to capitalism very seriously.
"Now would you like to tell me what the hell this is all about, General? You have abducted..."
General China held up a hand to stop him, lifted the field telephone on his desk and spoke quietly in Portuguese. He hung up and glanced expectantly towards the screen doorway. The canvas curtain was drawn aside, and 3 persons came into the dugout. There were 2 uniformed black women carrying AK rifles, and between them was Claudia Montero. At the sight of her, Sean's heart seemed to swell against his ribs, and then race away again. Claudia! The blood drained from her face.
"Oh, my God," she whispered. "I was so afraid. Sean."
She threw herself into his arms.
"Darling," he whispered, and stroked her hair. "My darling, it's all right now."
She lifted her face to him, and he kissed her. Her lips opened under his, and her mouth was hot and sweet.
"Better than I hoped for," General China said quietly.
Sean turned to General China.
"Okay, you bastard.
What do you want?"
"At first, nothing more than retribution." General China touched his ear. "I knew you were operating the Chiwewe hunting concessions. In fact, as a junior minister of Mugabe's government, I was one of those who gave approval to the grant. I thought even then that it might be useful to have you so close to the border." Sean forced himself to relax. "You certainly get around," he said. "Marxist government minister one day, Renamo warlord the next." China waved a hand deprecatingly.
I enlisted in the guerrilla army for the good capitalistic reason that at the time it was the best way to get on in life. Does that make any sense to you, Colonel? Perfect sense. Sean's smile was genuine. It's a well-known fact that the only way communism can be made to work is if you have capitalists to pay the bill and manage the show. China nodded his appreciation. I only found that out once Zandler had ousted Smith and taken over the government in Harare. As a former guerrilla, I was feared and mistrusted by the fat cats who had avoided the actual fighting, but now had taken control of the show. Far from receiving my just reward, I was more likely to end up in Chikarubi prison, so I allowed my capitalistic instinct to guide me. With a few other like-minded citizens, we were arranging another change of government when somebody boasted to a woman. She told her other lover, who just happened to be Mugabe's chief of intelligence. And I was forced to cross the border in some haste. But why Renamo? Sean asked. Some future reward? Naturally. When I've assisted Renamo to form the new government of Mozambique with South Africa as its ally, between them, they'll be able to force a change of government in Zimbabwe. A new president to replace Mugabe. From General China to President China, Sean cut in. You don't think small. I'm touched by your appreciation of my aspirations. But where does all this leave me? China touched his ear. To tell the truth, I'd arranged a nocturnal raid on your camp when a change of plan was forced upon me. Sean raised an eyebrow. Very recently there's been a drastic alteration in the balance of power here. We of Renamo control all the country except the major towns. We've reduced food production to the point where Frelimo must rely almost entirely on foreign aid. And we've virtually strangled their transport system. Our forces move freely about the countryside, recruiting from the villages, and we have, in fact, set up our own alternative administration. However, 3 weeks ago, the Soviets delivered a squadron of Hind helicopters to the Frelimo Air Force. Sean whistled softly. Hinds? In Afghanistan, they called them the Flying Death. Here, we call them Henshaw, the Falcons. The Russians have supplied technicians, munitions, and spares, as well as pilots. They aim to smash Renamo in 6 months.
Can they succeed?
Yes, China said firmly. Already they've severely limited our mobility. Without mobility, a guerrilla army is defeated, and our morale is crumbling. Instead of looking proudly ahead, my men cringe and look to the skies. It's not an easy life, General, Sean commiserated. I'm sure you'll come up with something. I already have, China nodded. You, as the Americans say, you owe me one. He touched his ear. All right, Sean nodded with resignation. Spill it out. The plan that I have in mind requires a white officer who understands black troops and speaks their language, and your Matabeles are part of my calculations. He lifted the handset of the telephone and spoke into it again, then looked up at Sean. The two of them will be required to work with you, and there's an excellent chance that with all your cooperation, I will be persuaded to give you your freedom. Of course, that offer includes Miss Montero. General China turned to the lieutenant, who came through the doorway and said in Shangani, 10 minutes with the Matabele prisoners. 3 men escorted Sean and Claudia out into the dazzling sunshine and across to a single hut of mud daub and thatch, surrounded by a stockade of poles and barbed wire, the whole covered by a camouflage net. As a warder opened the gate to the stockade, there was an abrupt shrilling of alarm whistles and wild shouts.
"What's going on?"
Sean demanded. But the guards were scattering, unslinging their weapons and peering up at the sky. Job was at Sean's shoulder.
Air raid! Frelimo gunships!
Sean heard the engines. He saw Dedan run out of the hut as the whistle of approaching rotors was punctuated by the crackle and rap of ground fire.
Come on, Claudia! Sean yelled. We're making a break. Which way, Job?
and the river.
Job responded immediately.
Lead the way,
Sean shouted, as all around them rose the stutter of automatic small arms fire, the deeper clatter of heavy machine guns. Then even that din was drowned out by a thunder like the Victoria Falls in flood, the sound of the Gatling multi-barreled cannon mounted in the nose of a Hind helicopter. He felt Claudia falter beside him and jerked her arm.
Come on,
he snarled at her.
Run!
She was limping slightly as they followed Job and Dedan down towards the river. Just ahead of them was open ground. A small party of Renamo were doubling across this opening, coming up the track towards them, each carrying an RPG mobile rocket launcher. As they ran, their faces were turned up towards the sky, seeking a target for their rockets. The detachment was still 200 meters away when suddenly the earth around them erupted. Sean had never, in all his war experience, seen anything like it. The ground seemed to turn to a liquid that boiled into a fog of dust under the jet of 12.7-millimeter cannon shells. Even the trees disappeared in a whirlwind of wood fragments and shredded leaves, and the ground was left like the furrows of a freshly ploughed field. The party of RPG men were minced as though they had been fed through the cogs of some fearsome machinery. Sean pulled Claudia down into the grass beside the track just as the Hind cruised overhead, and abruptly they had a full view of the machine. Sean had not expected it to be so large and so grotesquely ugly. The Russians themselves called it Sturmovich, the humpback. It was 50 feet long, a deformed monster. The green and brown splotches of tropical camouflage gave it the appearance of leprous decay. The bulging double canopies of armored glass looked like malevolent eyes. Below the gross body hung an assembly of rocket pods, and as they stared at it in awe, the machine rotated on its own axis, lowered its blunt nose, and fired a spread of rockets. They launched on fiery plumes of white smoke, streaking down and bursting on the ants' nests of sandbagged bunkers in fountains of flame, smoke, and dust. The noise was deafening. Claudia covered her ears and sobbed. The Hind revolved slowly and moved away from them, hunting along the bank of the river.
Let's go!
Sean shouted above the uproar and dragged Claudia to her feet. As they passed the dead men, Job snatched up one of the RPG launchers and a backpack that contained three of the finned projectiles. Then he went bounding on towards the riverbank. As Job and Dedan reached the riverbank, Job looked back at them anxiously. He screamed a warning, dropped the pack and swung the RPG up onto his shoulder, pointing it at the sky above Sean's head. Sean did not look up. The shrieking roar of the second incoming Hind was escalating to the point of pain. Running beside them was a narrow donga, and Sean swept Claudia off her feet and jumped with her in his arms. The gully was 6 feet deep, and they hit the bottom just as the top dissolved under a jet of cannon fire. The earth on which they lay shuddered like a live thing, and on the cliff above the river, Job aimed the RPG at a huge gunship. The exhaust of white smoke blew back over his shoulder, and the rocket streaked away, flying fair and true, to strike where the armored glass canopy joined the metal fuselage. For an instant, the front of the Hind was obliterated by flame and smoke, and Job whooped triumphantly, expecting the monster to crash out of the sky. Instead, the huge helicopter jumped higher, as though the pilot had flinched, and when the smoke blew away, Job realized with disbelief that the fuselage was unscathed. As he stared, the ugly nose of the Hind swiveled towards him. Job dropped the RPG launcher and jumped from the clifftop, dropping 20 feet to hit the water, just as the cannon tore apart the tree under which he had stood. The Hind pulled away. Dedan was down, his brain bulging out, white and glistening through a rent in his skull. Sean crawled to his knees, coughing and gasping, and half-pushed, half-pulled Claudia up the side of the gully. But the Shangani sergeant had found them. One of his troopers grabbed Claudia's arm and dragged her away. Another lifted his AK butt to strike her in the chest. Sean caught the man and stifled the blow.
Do that again, he said softly in Shangani, and I'll hack off your entendo and make you eat it.
The trooper stared at him, amazed, and the sergeant let out a bellow of laughter.
Better do what he says, he warned his trooper. Unless you're very hungry. Then he grinned at Sean. So, you talk Shangani like one of us. I won't let you fool me again.
They were dragged unceremoniously into General China's bunker and paraded before his desk. He nodded at the female jailers who grabbed Claudia, spun her around, and pulling her arms behind her back, snapped steel manacles onto her wrists. She gasped with pain.
Tell that bitch to loosen them,
Sean snapped at General China. She's cutting off the circulation. Miss Montero could lose her hands to gangrene.
That would be unfortunate, General China agreed. However, I will not interfere unless I'm assured of your complete cooperation and unless I have your parole that you will not attempt another escape.
Sean looked down at Claudia's hands. Already they were beginning to swell, the veins puffing up into dark blue cords below the manacles.
All right, Sean said heavily. I give you my parole. And cooperation.
Sean and Job slept on the floor of a dugout with a guard sitting over them. The sergeant woke them in the dark of pre-dawn.
Get dressed, he ordered.
Sean sat up.
What's your name?
Alfonso Henriquez Mabasa, the Shangani told him proudly.
Sean smiled at the unlikely combination of the name of a Portuguese emperor and the Shangani name for one who strikes with a club. Breakfast was a stew of dried fish and a porridge of maize meal. Dawn was just breaking when Alfonso escorted them down to the riverbank where they found General China and his staff inspecting the damage done by the Hind gunships.
We lost 26 men killed and wounded yesterday,
China greeted Sean,
and almost as many deserters during the night. Unless we stop those gunships, it'll be over in 3 months. Our friends in the south have offered us their new DARTA missile system, but it's truck-mounted. We need a weapon that can be carried and used by foot soldiers.
Yeah, there's only one that's effective, Sean said.
The Americans adapted the Stinger missile in Afghanistan.
Correct, Colonel. And that's the price of your freedom. I want you to pick up a shipment of Stingers for me.
China's expression was bleak.
You remember the old Rhodesian Fire Force base at Grand Reef? The Stingers are there.
Sean shook his head.
The Yanks would never give Stingers to Mugabe. It doesn't make sense.
Oh, yes, it does, China assured him. The Americans dislike Mugabe, but they dislike the South Africans more.
Mugabe is harboring ANC guerrillas operating across his borders into South Africa, and the South Africans have vowed to pursue the guerrillas wherever they run. Mugabe wants a weapon to deal with their Puma gunships when they cross his border to cull the ANC, and the British are training Mugabe's army for him. They have the Stingers from the Americans, and they're training Mugabe's crack 3rd Brigade to use them at Grand Reef. They were delivered 14 days ago and are to be deployed along the South African and Zimbabwe border. They'll be aimed at your countrymen, Colonel Courtney.
Sean felt a stirring of patriotic outrage, but he kept his expression neutral.
The training is being conducted by Royal Artillery personnel, a captain and 2 NCOs, so you'll understand why I require a white face for my plan. I want you to go back to Zimbabwe and bring me those Stinger missiles. Train my men to use them and destroy the Hind squadron.
You spoke of a plan, General China. What do you have in mind?
Some time ago, my men captured 3 Zimbabwe Unimog trucks. My plan is for you to cross the border disguised as Zimbabwean troops.
Sean nodded.
It would need more than the 10 men in Sergeant Alfonso's squad, he said. I have a hand-picked company of 40 men. They would need Zimbabwe army uniforms and something for me. I have them, and a British officer's uniform for you, China said. We'll have to wheedle our way into the base without firing a shot.
I also have the necessary papers. I have a man inside the base. He's a warrant officer in the communications center. He'll be able to supply us with passes and fake a signal from the Zimbabwe High Command authorizing an inspection of the Stinger program by the military attaché. So the guards will be expecting you. If you have a man inside the base, he'll know where the Stingers are stored, Job suggested eagerly. China nodded. Number three hangar. Sean frowned. Okay, we've got in. We have the Stingers loaded in the Unimogs. Now we have to get out. We'll need a diversion. A second unit to stage an attack and lure most of the guards to the southern perimeter of the base on the far side of the airfield. Then we charge the gates, Job said. Yes, Sean nodded. And then we aren't going to be able to get out through the border post at Umtali. By that time, the whole Zimbabwe army and Frelimo will all be after us. China snapped an order, and one of his staff stepped forward, opening up a map. Sean located the road that branched northwards. He touched one of the valleys, a green wedge driven deeply into the barrier of mountains. Honda Valley, he read the legend. The road crossed the head of it, and the valley itself was a funnel that led down to the border and the Mozambique uplands. It formed a natural gateway, which had been one of the major infiltration routes of the Zanla guerrillas from Mozambique. Sean and Job had learned its hidden trails and strong points the hard way. The track down to St. Mary's Mission, Sean said. That's as far as we can take the trucks. From there is only 6 Ks to the border, Job murmured. 6 hard Ks, Sean qualified. And we won't be clear just because we've crossed into Mozambique. We will still have them after us until we get into Renamo-held ground. Sean turned back to General China. I'll want porters waiting for us at St. Mary's Mission. How far does your control of territory extend? The porters will present no problem. China pointed to a speck on the map marked Mavanela. And I can have trucks waiting at this village. All right. Let's draw up a timetable, Sean said. Let's get it all down on paper. Colonel, China gave that thin, cold smile that Sean was coming to loathe. Training on the Stingers is complete. They will be moved out of Grand Reef within the next 72 hours, depending on availability of transport aircraft. Sean whistled softly. In that case, we won't make it. The smile vanished. For Miss Montero's sake, you had better make it. If you don't, she will have no further value to me. All right. Sean contained his fury. I'll take command of the men now. Follow me. China broke off as the mournful wail of the sirens rose from the camp around them, and instantly everything was in turmoil. The hinds! Shouted China. Take cover! And he sprinted for a sandbagged anti-aircraft emplacement amongst the trees nearby. In the long grass on the opposite side of the track, Sean spotted a less conspicuous shell scrape and ran for it. As he tumbled into it, he heard the oncoming roar of the hind gunships. Job jumped down and squatted beside him, and then another smaller figure leapt into the hole. The wrinkled face creased like a used napkin into a wide black smile, and the man said happily, I see you, Bwana.
You? You silly little bugger. Sean stared in disbelief. I sent you back to Chiwewe. What the hell are you doing here?
I went back to Chiwewe, as you commanded, Matatu said virtuously. Then I came back to look for you.
Sean still stared at Matatu in awe. Then he began to smile. Nobody saw you? He demanded in Swahili.
Nobody sees Matatu when Matatu does not want to be seen.
The earth trembled under them, and the sound of rockets and gunfire forced them to put their heads close together.
Matatu, these Undeki. They are heavy with armor, so their range is limited. Their base can't be too far. Could you find the place where they come from and return to? Matatu grinned.
Matatu can follow anything, man or animal or Undeki. Anywhere it goes, he boasted confidently.
Find the place. Find it. Then come back here. Sean looked up at the sky. The raid had been fierce but short-lived. Go, now, Sean ordered. Matatu jumped to his feet, eager to obey. Don't let them catch you, old friend.
They waited to let Matatu get clear and then climbed out of the shelter. The trees around them were torn and shattered, and across the river, an ammunition store was burning and exploding, sending dense white smoke towering into the sky. General China came striding down the path, his expression furious.
Get me those stingers, he hissed. Get them, and get them quickly.
They crossed the border without incident, and on the back of the Unimog, the troopers were singing as the column wound down the hill to the town of Umtali.
Back home again, Job chuckled. Nothing to it.
Back home, Sean agreed. And back home is where you are going to stay.
Job turned his head.
What do you mean?
You aren't coming to Grand Reef, Job, and you sure as hell aren't coming back to Mozambique with me. Get rid of that uniform as soon as you can. Take the next train to Harare and collect Capo's dollars. Sit in the sun and drink a few pots of beer.
You remember that day we met, huh? On Hill 31, Job asked quietly. You came back for me. And I'm coming back with you, Sean.
Then he gave his full attention to driving, leading the column of trucks sedately through the sleeping town of Umtali and out on the open highway. He read the road sign in the beam of the headlights.
Grand Reef Military Base, 15 kilometers.
Sean felt the familiar tightness in his stomach muscles. It was always like this.
There she is,
Job said softly as they topped a rise in the highway. The airfield was fully lit, the beacon lights glowing orange. In the stark white light of the floods, even at a distance of almost 2 miles, the Hercules looked gigantic, the Royal Air Force roundels painted on the monstrous silver fuselage.
Pull over, Sean ordered,
and Job flicked his indicators. Sean jumped down from the cab and ran back to the second truck, just as Alfonso climbed down to the roadside.
Sergeant, I'll give you 45 minutes to get into position, then exactly 10 minutes of diversionary fire, and pull out fast. Understood?
Yeah, bo.
Go, said Sean. And Alfonso jumped up into the cab. Through the open window, he saluted Sean as the Unimog headed down the highway towards the brightly lit base.
Sean marked the time on his Rolex and walked back to join Job in the leading truck. He focused his binoculars at the huge aircraft. The tail ramp at the rear of the fuselage was lowered like a drawbridge. There were 4 or 5 figures moving about inside the hold, and 2 more at the foot of the ramp. As he watched, a forklift truck trundled out of the open doors of number 3 hangar, loaded with a stack of long wooden cases.
They're loading the stingers, Sean said.
The forklift truck climbed the open ramp and disappeared into the cargo hold. Minutes later, it reappeared, drove down the ramp, and wheeled into the hangar. Sean glanced at his watch.
Come on,
Sean muttered, and shook the Rolex as if to speed up the mechanism. Twice more they watched the forklift make the journey. But then it parked.
Loading completed, Sean whispered, and checked his watch. 7 minutes.
Through his binoculars, Sean saw the men who had been working in the cargo hold come down the ramp.
Okay, Job. Go.
Job kicked the engine to life, and the Unimog pulled forward. In the rear-view mirror, Sean watched the second truck fall in behind them. As they turned into the base gates, Sean picked out the window of his old office in the main block beyond the control tower. Then Job lowered the side window and exchanged the passwords with the commander of the guard, handing him the plastic-covered pass. The man took it to the guardhouse, made an entry in the register. Then two of his men opened the main gates, and he waved the convoy through. Job drove slowly, obeying the on-base 15 miles per hour speed limit. He swung the truck across the hard stand into the shadowy area at the back of the hangar. As the truck stopped, Sean jumped down and glanced around him quickly. The second Unimog pulled in beside the first, and armed men in battle dress swarmed out over the tailgates of both.
Job! Get them!
Sean broke off as heavy gunfire broke out on the southern perimeter. Alfonso had started his attack. They heard the whoosh-boom of RPG-7 rockets and the duller thud-thud of mortar shells. The 12.7mm machine gun at the gates opened up, sluicing green tracer in pretty parabolas high into the darkness. Sirens began to howl like wolves, and the floodlights were extinguished, except for fiery bead necklaces of tracer flying across the dark sky and the brief glare of exploding rockets. The base was in darkness. Sean felt cold and resilient as a knife blade. He knew exactly what he was going to do.
Job, get the men into the Hercules, he shouted. We're getting out in the aircraft. Move your ass.
Job ran, shouting orders. Sean went after him. Although he did not have the Hercules conversion endorsed on his license, Sean had flown almost 200 hours in the co-pilot's seat with the South African Air Force in Angola and Namibia on anti-terrorist ops. Sean led the way up the ramp and stopped at the top.
Here is the control for the ramp.
He showed Job the rocker switch, then ran down the length of the Hercules. The Shanganis were milling about uncertainly in the darkness.
Ferdinand! Sean shouted. Get them on the side benches and strapped in!
Through the cockpit window, he saw that the attack on the perimeter was still in full swing. He climbed into the left-hand seat and switched on the Hercules instrument panel. The vast array of glowing dials and switches was intimidating, but Sean would not let himself be daunted.
The hell with startup checks, he said, and hit the switch for the number one engine.
The starter motor whined, and he watched the needle creep around the rev counter. He wound her up to 70% of power while he adjusted the earphones of the radio.
Job, do you read? Loud and clear, man. Get the ramp up. It's on its way.
One after the other, Sean coaxed the other three engines to life. And the moment the ramp warning lamp switched from red to green, he kicked off the wheel brakes and the Hercules rolled ponderously forward. The plane required only a short takeoff distance, and Sean steered her for the main runway intersection directly in front of the control tower. So far, they had drawn no fire, but at the southern perimeter, the fire of the 3rd Brigade veterans was professional, deadly, and already they had almost entirely extinguished Alfonso's onslaught. Sean was taxiing the Hercules at a reckless speed. Behind him, Job barged open the door to the flight deck.
The men are strapped in ready for takeoff, he called. Get into the right-hand seat and strap in, Sean ordered.
The needles were touching the bottom of the green. The main runway was coming up fast. Sean towed the wheel brakes and swung the monstrous aircraft onto it. He advanced the bank of throttle controls smoothly, and at that moment, the heavy machine gun beyond the tower opened up on them. However, the Hercules was accelerating strongly, and the fire was high as well as behind.
That cat needs shooting lessons,
Job remarked calmly. The next burst was low and ahead, the tracer splashing across the runway under the Hercules' nose.
But he learns fast.
Sean felt the controls come to life in his hand and eased back. The great aircraft responded willingly, pointing her nose upwards. It seemed impossible that the enormous target offered by the Hercules had received only a single burst of fire, but the needles on the dials all registered normal. The slipstream was whistling through the bullet holes in the canopy, making conversation difficult.
He had to raise his voice as he told Job, "Go back and see if anyone was hit, then do a visual check for damage." The adrenaline was still thick in his blood, the rapture of fear swirling him aloft, and he laughed, savoring the glorious thrill of it. The dark mountaintops slid away beneath him, just visible in the starlight like the shape of whales deep in an Arctic sea. As he crossed the frontier into Mozambique, there was nothing but darkness ahead. Sean began a gradual descent towards the low forests. Now that the mountain peaks were behind them, he didn't want to stay up high, offering an easy target for the attack radar of an intercepting hind gunship. Job came back onto the flight deck.
"Any damage?"
Job chuckled.
"And the floor of the cargo hold is ankle-deep in puke. Man, those Shanganis are upchucking in all directions. How long before the MiGs catch us?"
Sean shook his head.
"They're based in Harare. I don't think they can. But the Hinds are another story. Another 2 hours before it will be light enough to even start looking for an emergency landing field," Sean told Job. "In the meantime, we try to find the Punwe River."
An hour later, they spotted the gleam of water in the black carpet of forest ahead, and seconds later the stars were reflected from a large body of dark water directly below them.
"Looks like it," Sean grunted. "But we won't be able to judge whether we're upstream or downstream of the lines until sunrise." "So, what do we do?" "We fly a holding pattern," Sean explained,
banking the Hercules into the first of a monotonous series of figures of eight, marking time until dawn. When the sky was pale enough, Job went back and brought Ferdinand up.
"Look out there, Ferdinand," Sean gesticulated through the bullet-punctured canopy. "Do you see anything you recognize?"
The Shangani peered dubiously around, and then suddenly his expression lightened.
"Are those hills?" he pointed out of the side window. "The river comes out between them at a waterfall. The camp is that way." "How far?"
2 full days.
70 miles. "Thank you, Ferdinand."
Sean flew westwards, while behind them the dawn turned the eastern sky a hazy carmine. The Hercules was fast approaching the gap in the hills where the river tumbled down over wet black rock, when Job yelled,
"Incoming! 1 o'clock! Low!"
The hind had been lying in ambush, squatting like some monstrous insect in a clearing in the forest. It leapt out of the forest, rising vertically, obscenely, ugly and deadly. Sean rammed the throttles fully open, thrust the nose down, and dived straight at the helicopter. He saw the rockets leaving the weapon pods under the hind's wings, the barrage flashing past his head, a storm of smoke and death.
"Hold on!" Sean shouted at Job. "I'm going to ram the bastard!"
The Russian pilot's face was doughy white as he flicked the gunship over on its side, almost inverting it as he tried to duck under the Hercules.
"Got you, you son of a bitch!"
Sean exulted, and the Hercules' wing hit the tail of the gunship. The Hercules shuddered and lurched as airspeed was knocked off her, and she quivered on the edge of a stall only 200 feet above the forest.
"Come on, pussycat," Sean whispered.
He was babying the controls, coaxing her with gentle fingers. Her damaged wing was down, tatters of torn metal whipping and banging in the slipstream, and the forest tops reached up to claw them out of the sky.
"Fly for me, darling,"
Sean whispered, and the four engines, howling with effort, held her up and then gradually lifted her clear.
"Where's the hind?"
Sean yelled at Job.
"She must be down,"
Job called back, both of them screaming at each other with terror and triumph.
"Nothing could take a hit like that."
Then his voice changed.
"No. There she is.
She's still flying. My God, will you look at that mother?"
The hind was skittering out to one side, the tail rotor and the rudder almost completely gone. The pilot was fighting for his life as it rolled and wallowed. Sean aimed for the pass through the hills. The rocky cliffs seemed to brush their wingtips.
He's fired a missile.
As Job called the warning, the pass through the hills opened up ahead of them, and Sean lifted the Hercules' maimed wing high in a maximum rate turn. The huge aircraft hugged the cliff face, turning the corner just as the missile locked onto the infrared emissions of her exhausts and sped down the gut of the pass.
Ah, she's down!
Job watched the tail rotor of the gunship break away, the body drop, and hit the trees in a tall burst of flame.
Break right!
Job called desperately. Sean had the Hercules over as hard as she would go. The missile went skidding wide, but it corrected and came around and fastened on the starboard number two motor. The Hercules convulsed as though in agony, and Sean looked across in horror at the damage. The number two engine was gone, leaving a gaping wound. Sean looked ahead. There was the river, wide, shallow, and tranquil. The first rays of the sun were buttering the tops of the trees on either bank, and the crocodiles lay black on the white sandbanks. Sean flipped on the internal tannoy.
Hold on! We're going to hit hard, he said in Shangani.
The Hercules lumbered down, dropping like an express elevator. Gingerly, Sean pulled on full flap to slow her down. The Hercules responded and floated in with a semblance of her old elegance. Sean felt the tail touch the water, then she belly-flopped into the river. A solid green wave broke over the nose, spurting in through the bullet holes. Both Sean and Job were flung forward violently against their shoulder harnesses, and then the Hercules surfed on her belly, slowed down, and turned to stop broadside to the current.
Are you all right?
Sean barked at Job. For reply, Job unbuckled his harness and leapt out of the co-pilot's seat. The deck was canted under Sean as he stood up. Through the canopy he could see they were aground on a sandbar close under the bank. The water looked barely waist deep.
Come on!
He led Job back into the main hold. The Shanganis were in a panic, at least two of them injured.
We must move fast, Sean told Job. The rest of the Hinds will come looking for us. Unload the stingers. Get them busy.
Sean found that the hydraulic rams on the cargo door were still operating off the batteries, and he lowered the ramp. The weight of each wooden case was stenciled on it, 154 pounds.
Two men to a case, Sean ordered.
He and Job lifted them onto the shoulders of each pair as they stepped forward. It took 20 minutes to unload the cargo, and every minute Sean expected to hear the approaching whine of rotors. They had two injured troopers. One had a set of cracked ribs, the other a broken collarbone, and there were 35 cases to carry, with only 20 uninjured men. Sean concealed the boxes they were forced to leave, and, carrying what they could, they set out along the bank of the Pungwe River, groping for a contact with the Renamo front line. They marched all that night. The extended column, slowed by the heavy cases, covered only 12 miles before sunrise. However, the weather had changed and the wind had backed into the east, bringing in low cloud and a cold drizzle that would hide them. They kept going all that day, without any contact from the Hinds. An hour after sunrise the next morning, the clouds rolled away and their sodden battle dress steamed as it dried on their backs. 2 hours later, they ran into a Renamo patrol and were surrounded by grinning men, shaking hands and laughing and slapping each other's backs. A detachment was sent back to fetch the cases they'd hidden, and their progress became a triumphal march as news of their success flashed through the Renamo lines ahead of them. General China was waiting to greet them, resplendent in battle dress and decorations.
I knew you would not fail me, Colonel.
For the first time in their acquaintance, Sean had the feeling that his smile was genuine.
We lost almost 30 men under Sergeant Alfonso, Sean told him brusquely. No, no, Colonel.
General China clasped his shoulder in an unparalleled display of goodwill.
Alfonso got out safely. He lost only 3 men. I've just had radio contact with them. They'll be in our lines by tomorrow evening. The entire operation was a brilliant success. I think you've saved the cause, and I'm grateful. That's fine, China. But don't just tell me how grateful. Show me. Of course. Forgive me. In the excitement, I almost forgot. There's somebody very anxious to see you. Sean felt his breathing shorten and his chest constrict. Where is she? I have prepared quarters for you. From now on, you are an honored and privileged guest. One of my junior officers will escort you. The dugout to which the subaltern led him was in the bush above the river bank. The only furnishings were a table and two stools against one wall, and opposite a raised bedstead. Claudia was sitting on a stool. He spoke her name when he saw her, and she came to her feet slowly, staring at him, white-faced. The bones of her cheeks threatened to burst through the almost translucent skin, and her eyes were huge and dark as midnight. As he crossed to her, Sean saw the marks on her wrists, livid weals crusted with fresh scab, and his anger matched his joy. He swept her into his arms. For a moment she stood, quiescent in his embrace, and then fiercely she threw her arms around his neck and hugged him. They stood, locked together, as Sean told her of her father's death, and he felt the wetness soaking through his shirt front. Please, don't cry. It's just that I'm so happy now. She smiled through the last of her tears. Papa died as he would have wished, and nothing else matters now you are back. He took her hands and lifted them to his lips, kissing the broken, scabbed skin on her wrists. Then Sean kissed her mouth. They undressed each other with aching deliberation, and Sean lifted Claudia onto the bed, beneath a mosquito net. The one extraordinary luxury. It was darkening outside the dugout when a man coughed politely behind the screen doorway.
Dinner is ready, sir and madam.
They ate in dedicated silence, smiling across the table at each other between mouthfuls. At last, Claudia groaned softly.
I think I can just walk as far as the bed, but definitely no further.
Suits me fine, said Sean, and reached across to take her hand. They slept so intricately entwined that their hearts beat against each other and their breath mingled. Claudia woke suddenly, feeling the tension in Sean's body against hers, and instantly he touched her lips to caution her to silence. She lay frozen in the darkness. Then she heard it, a soft scraping at the entrance of the dugout. Her heart raced away, and she bit her lip to stop herself gasping aloud. Fast as a striking adder, Sean lunged through the mosquito net, and there was a quick scuffle and squeal.
Got you, you silly little bugger, Sean said grimly. You don't sneak up on me twice and get away with it.
My brother, Matatu giggled and wriggled like a puppy.
Where have you been, Matatu? Sean demanded sternly. What took you so long? Did you meet a pretty girl along the way?
Matatu giggled again.
I found the roosting place of the henshaw, he boasted.
Tell me, Sean ordered.
And in the darkness, Matatu made little self-important throat-clearing and humming sounds.
There is a round hill, Matatu began. On one side of the hill passes the Insimbi, the railway, and on the other side, the road. There are many askari around the hill, with big bandoki hidden in holes in the ground.
Sean formed a vivid mental picture of the heavily garrisoned hilltop, as Matatu described it to him. Beyond the outer defensive lines, the gunships were lagered in separate sandbagged emplacements. Like battle tanks in hull-down fortifications, they would be impregnable, and yet they had only to rise and hover to bring into action their devastating firepower.
Inside the circle of roosting henshaw, there are many harries parked, and white men in green clothes who climb on the henshaw and look inside them all the time.
Matatu described the mobile workshops, the fuel tankers, and the squads of Russian technicians needed to keep the helicopters flying.
Matatu, did you see Railway Harries on the line near the hill? Sean asked.
I saw them, Matatu confirmed.
Fuel for the gunships was obviously being railed from Harare in bulk tankers and transshipped into smaller road tankers. It was ironic that the fuel was certainly being originally supplied by the South Africans. However, if the helicopter squadron was storing its fuel within the lager itself, they were taking a grave risk. Matatu remained at the bedside for almost an hour while Sean patiently drew from him every possible detail he could of the gunship lager. Matatu was certain that there were 11 helicopters in the emplacements. Matatu was equally certain that only 9 of the gunships were actually flying. When at last Matatu had finished his recitation, he asked simply,
Now, my Bwana, what do you want me to do?
I want you to keep out of sight. Do not let any of the men here see you, except Job and me.
I heard you, my Bwana.
Come to me each night, as you have tonight. I will have food for you, and I will tell you what to do. In the meantime, watch and tell me all you see.
Matatu went silently, and Claudia asked softly,
Will he be all right?
Of all of us, he is the most likely to survive.
In the dark, Sean smiled fondly after the little man. It was still dark when Sean turned Job out of his blanket the next morning.
We've got work to do. The sooner we get the Stingers into action, the sooner we get the hell out of here.
Claudia joined them in the dugout as they started examining the crates from the Hercules. 33 were marked Stinger Guided Missile System, 1 gripstock and antenna, 1 interrogator, 5 loaded launch tubes. One of the 2 remaining cases was stenciled Stinger Guided Missile System Training Set M134 Tracking Head Trainer.
This will make life a lot easier, Job said cheerfully.
However, it was not until Sean examined the last case that the full value of the prize dawned on them. It was stenciled Stinger Guided Missile System Post Modification Software.
Sweet Trinity, Sean whistled.
What have we got ourselves here?
The software was contained in a heavy-duty plastic carry pack. Dozens of software cassettes, each color-coded and sealed in transparent envelopes. Job pulled out the manuals and they squatted beside the open case, poring through its pages.
Here it is, a hind attack system, a color code red, numerical code S42A.
Job read aloud from the manual.
System software cassette, S-42A, is targeted on the hind helicopter gunship. With the cassette inserted in the launcher's microprocessor, the system switches automatically into two-color seeker mode, which registers both infrared and ultraviolet emissions in 2 stages. The initial stage, for missile launch, will lock to infrared from the engine exhaust system below the main fuselage, but missile strikes have proved ineffective against these outlets, which are protected by heavily armored exhaust suppressors. The S-42A modification automatically switches the guidance system of the Stinger into ultraviolet seeker mode when range to target is reduced to 100 meters. Ultraviolet is emitted principally from the air intake ports of the Isotov TV-3117 turboshaft engines. This area is the only section of the fuselage not encased in titanium armor plate, and missile strikes through the engine intake ports have resulted in 100% kills. Big casino, Job said,
and closed the manual with a snap.
Right, Sean told Job and Claudia. Now we can uncrate the trainer set and one of the launches. From now on, it's look and learn, show and tell time.
Sean was relieved and pleased to discover that the operation of the equipment was not a great deal more complicated than the conventional RPG-7 rocket launchers. The RPG-7 was so much a part of the guerrilla arsenal that, as Job remarked, every man in China's division could load and lock on a pitch-dark night in a thunderstorm. Claudia found the section of the manual dealing with the IFF, and under her tutelage, they disarmed the system, converting the Stinger into a free-fire weapon which would attack any aircraft at which it was aimed.
"Even a Shangani could learn how to fire one of these," Job said,
and Sean grinned. "Let's take a look at the trainer."
After they had connected the battery pack and assembled the trainer, Sean gave his opinion.
"With this stuff, we can have the lads ready to go into action within days, not weeks."
Sean and Job played with the trainer like a pair of teenagers, flying the image in complicated maneuvers.
"It's just like a Pac-Man game," Job enthused. "But what we need is a dum-dum, a pseudo-Shangani, to act as a trainee for us."
Once more, both the men looked at Claudia, who was studying the manual. She looked up.
"A dum-dum?" she demanded. "I'll show you, dum-dum. Give me the launcher."
She stood, with the launcher balanced on her shoulder, and stared into the sighting screen. The bulky equipment seemed to dwarf her.
"Ready?" Sean asked.
"Pull," she said, concentrating ferociously on the screen.
"Incoming!"
Sean called sharply. He brought the Ghost Hind in on a head-on attack at 150 knots.
"Actuator on,"
Claudia said calmly, and a second later they heard the launcher settle into a steady whine.
"Target acquired," Claudia murmured.
"Fire!" And almost instantaneously, the image of the Hind disappeared from the screen to be replaced by the flashing legend, "Target destroyed." There followed a profound silence. Job cleared his throat nervously.
"Flukes happen," said Sean. "Shall we try it again?"
"Paul," said Claudia. Sean brought the next Hind in from behind her at treetop level and flung it into a climbing sideslip, giving her deflection in three planes. It would be like trying to hit a high bird in a gale of crosswind. In their screen, they watched with disbelief as Claudia swung smoothly, keeping the image in the exact center of her aiming ring. The screen blinked at them, "Target destroyed," and they fidgeted uncomfortably. Job murmured,
"Twice on the trot. That ain't no fluke, man."
Claudia laid down the launcher and smiled at them sweetly.
"Would a daughter of Ricardo Montero not know how to shoot?"
"But you're stridently opposed to blood sports."
"Sure,
but I'm deaf to clay pigeons. Papa taught me."
Sean groaned softly.
"As a matter of interest, I was Alaska State Women's Champion, 3 years running." The two men exchanged embarrassed glances.
"All right, Miss Alaska," Sean told her sternly. "You're so damn clever, you've just landed yourself the job of instructor. From here on, you are in charge of this equipment. Job and I will split the Shanganis into two classes and give them the basics. Then we'll pass them on to you for simulation. It'll speed up the whole works."
General China interrupted them as he strode into the amphitheater.
"How soon can you begin training? Frelimo have launched a full-scale offensive, and as soon as my men attempt to hold them at a natural strong point, Frelimo calls in the Hinds. They simply obliterate our defenses. How soon can I send them the Stingers?"
2 days, said Sean.
"Is there no way you can hurry it up? I want at least one trained team immediately. Anything, to be able to hit back at them."
"If you deploy the Stingers piecemeal, you'll be tipping your hand to the Hind crews," Sean protested.
"Those Rusky pilots have met the Stingers before in Afghanistan. They'll know every countermeasure in the book, and then a few more. Right now, they're blissfully convinced they are the only things in the sky. Their guard is wide open, but you let one Stinger fly, and the rest of the squadron will be ready for you.
So, what do you suggest, Colonel?
Hit them when they are least expecting it. A full-scale surprise attack on their lager at dawn.
China shook his head irritably.
We don't know where their lager is.
I do, Sean contradicted. Give me 2 days, and we'll be ready to go.
China thought for a moment, staring up at the blue African sky as though he expected at any moment to see those dread humpbacked shapes appear.
2 days, he agreed at last.
Good.
Now, when do you expect Alfonso and his detachment to arrive? They'll be here in an hour, but they'll be exhausted. They've been in action for 24 hours.
They aren't on a Sunday school picnic.
Sean was callous.
Send them to me, as soon as they arrive.
When Matatu came creeping in out of the darkness, Sean fed him until his belly bulged.
All right, you greedy little bugger, Sean told him. Now it's time for you to earn your keep.
They led him up to the dark amphitheater where Job was waiting for them. He had already assembled the raw materials for building the scale model of the gunship lager. By the light of 2 paraffin lanterns, they started to lay it out, and it was well after midnight before Claudia and Sean crept under the mosquito net in their dugout. In the morning, while Claudia ran the last of the trainees through the attack sequences on the simulator, Sean and Job squatted beside the model of the gunship lager, and Sean explained his plans for the attack. Job listened attentively and made the occasional suggestion until they had it all clear in their own minds. The approach march, the attack, the withdrawal, and the alternatives if there was a hitch.
Okay, Sean stood up. Let's give it to the lads.
The Shangani troopers watched, totally absorbed, while Sean and Job described the plans for the raid. They used pebbles to denote the various units of the raiding party, moving them into place around the lager. 5 times they went over the action. In turn, each of the section leaders described it to them, and there were cheers each time the hinds were destroyed. General China had come up to stand amongst the trees at the riverside, watching with 12 officers and men of his personal bodyguard behind him. Now China stepped forward and instantly commanded the attention of every person in the amphitheatre.
I see your preparations are complete, Colonel Courtney, he greeted Sean.
Yes, we are ready, General.
Will you please go over the plans again, for my benefit?
Sean singled out Sergeant Alfonso.
Describe the raid for us again, he ordered.
And General China stood in front of the mock-up lager and watched with quick, bright eyes as Alfonso went through the plan step by step. The missile teams would move into position and lie in readiness 500 meters from the perimeter. 2 teams confronting each sandbagged emplacement. At the signal of a red flare, the assault team would attack from the south, hitting any fuel tankers that might be on the rail spur with RPG-7 rocket fire, sweeping the interior of the lager with mortars and then launching a frontal assault on the southern perimeter.
The Henshaw will take fright as soon as the shooting begins, Alfonso explained. They will try to escape by flying away. But there will be a moment when they rise from the earth that they will still be low down, standing still in the air, the way a falcon hovers before it stoops. That is the moment we will kill them.
China turned with satisfaction to Sean.
So, when will you move out?
This evening, 2 hours before dark. To penetrate the Frelimo lines during the night. And my woman comes with me.
China pretended to ponder that, and then nodded.
Very well. But if you fail me, then Alfonso will kill her.
China gave Sean a small, mocking salute.
One way or the other, we will not meet again, I'm afraid.
Sean leopard-crawled up onto the crest of a low, rocky kopje
and slid over the skyline, following Matatu into the dead ground below. Alfonso and the section leaders came silently down behind them, and Sean made sure they were settled into good cover before he raised his binoculars. He picked up the railway line immediately, less than 2 miles distant, the tracks gleaming dully in the late sunshine. He followed the tracks and found the spur onto which 2 railway tankers had been shunted. They were partially hidden by bush, but minutes later, a feather of dust rose out of the forest, and a fuel bowser came down a dirt track, pulling in beside the leading tanker. Sean watched as the workers connected up the delivery hose and began pumping fuel. A hind gunship rose with dramatic suddenness from the foreslope of the hill just beyond the railway spur, and at last Sean had a positive fix on the lager. The hind bore away, hump-backed and nose-heavy, for one more mission over the battlefield in the north before the light failed and the fighting was suspended for the night. Now Sean was able to make out other heavily camouflaged emplacements on the slopes of the hill. He counted 6 of them.
Ah, there are 2 more,
Matatu grinned patronizingly as he pointed out the emplacements that Sean had overlooked.
And there are 3 more on the far side of the hill.
The wisdom of making this reconnaissance in daylight became clearer as Sean was able to pick out the discrepancies between the model with which they had planned the raid and the actual lager. Sean jotted the amendments in his notebook, then one by one he called over each of the section leaders and pointed out exactly what position he wanted them to occupy as soon as their teams arrived under cover of darkness. Satisfied, Sean dispatched Matatu.
Go back to Job. As soon as it is dark, guide him and all the other soldiers up here.
When Matatu was gone, Sean devoted the last hour of daylight to watching the gunships return out of the north. There were 11 of them, ample proof of the efficiency of the Russian maintenance crews who must have repaired the 2 Hinds that Matatu had reported were not flying. Within the first hour of darkness, the troopers of the raiding column emerged from the trees. Job was at the head of the column, with Matatu guiding him, and Claudia beside him. The section leaders took charge of their missile teams, and the Stinger launchers were unpacked and assembled. Sean, Job, and Claudia went from team to team, running the final checks on the launchers. Satisfied at last, Sean dispatched the teams to their attack positions. There was no exchange of good wishes with Job. They were both superstitious about that. Job punched his shoulder and moved away so Sean could speak to Claudia in private.
I don't want to leave you, she whispered, and Sean hugged her fiercely. Come back to me safely. Promise me.
I promise, he said.
She pulled out of his embrace and turned away, disappearing into the darkness after Job. Sean found that his hands were trembling.
Love doesn't do much for one's fighting instincts, he thought,
and tried to dismiss her from his mind. It was after 2 o'clock in the morning. The small slice of the moon had set before Sean had the assault party spread out in their jump-off positions, and he settled down to wait. In the utter darkness of pre-dawn, Sean Courtney heard the shrill high whine of a mighty turbo engine howling like a man-eating wolf. It was joined almost at once by another, then another. The Hind squadron was warming up for their first sortie. Beside him, Matatu stirred, and the dawn wind came softly as a lover and stroked Sean's cheek. He turned his head towards the east and held up his hand with fingers spread. He could just make out the silhouette of his fingers. It was what the Matabele call the time of the horns, when a herdsman could first see the horns of his cattle against the sky.
Shooting light in 10 minutes, Sean reminded himself, and he knew how long it would take those minutes to pass.
One after the other, the Hinds shut down their engines to an idle. The ground crews would be completing the refueling and rearming. The flying crews would be going aboard. The light bloomed swiftly. Sean closed his eyes and counted slowly to 10 before he opened them again. Now he could make out the stark outline of the crest of the hill, like a cutout in black cardboard.
Shoot,
he said, and tapped the shoulder of the mortarman beside him. With a polite pop, the signal bomb was hurled 500 feet into the sky above the hilltop. It burst, crimson in the dawn sky, and the battle was born. The first RPG rocket flew into the nearest fuel tanker, and it erupted in a sheet of flames, illuminating the southern slope of the hill like noonday. The second tanker burst, blown clear of the railway lines by the explosion. Burning fuel flowed down the slope like lava, and from the perimeter, a 12.7mm cannon opened up, sluicing gaudy strings of tracer across the sky. A steady stream of mortar bombs were raining down onto the hilltop as Sean stood up.
"Go!"
he yelled.
"Go!"
The Shangani swept down the hill. Gunners on the hill fastened on them, and the tracer flew in clouds. Shit. Sean laughed in terror, plunging down the hill with flying strides, the shot so close he could feel the wind of it tugging at his tunic. Beside him, Matatu giggled shrilly, keeping pace with him. They hit the level ground beside the burning tankers, and the dense black smoke covered them from the Frelimo gunners. A sentry staggered up, one eye hanging on his cheek. Sean shot him in the belly and jumped the body. They came out of the smoke, and Sean saw the single strand of wire. Almost before he realized it, they were into the minefield that guarded the perimeter of the lager. 2 seconds later, the Shangani running on Sean's right triggered an anti-personnel mine. From the waist down, his body was obscured by the dust and flash of the explosion, and he dropped, with his legs blown to bloody stumps below the knees. 2 more Shangani went down before they were through, and charging the machine gun in its sandbagged emplacement. Sean was firing his AKM from the hip in short bursts, and he could see the barrel of the heavy machine gun swiveling onto him. He hurled himself forward, bullets whipping over his head, the muzzle blast beating in his eardrum. He rolled forward and came up hard against the parapet so he could have touched the muzzle. Sean unhooked a fragmentation grenade and popped it into the embrasure. The Frelimo gunner screamed, and the grenade exploded, blowing out through the opening. Sean rolled over the parapet. There were 2 men on the floor and 6 others sprinting away up the hill, unarmed and screaming with panic. Sean left Matatu to finish the 2 wounded men with his knife, while he seized the abandoned machine gun and manhandled it to the rear wall. He aimed it up the hill at the fleeing Frelimo and fired a long traversing burst. 2 of the runners dropped as his fire lashed the hillside. Backlit by the burning fuel tankers, a monstrous apparition appeared in the dawn sky ahead of Sean. Rising on its glittering rotor, turbos shrieking, a hind gunship lifted out of its sandbagged emplacement not 200 meters from where Sean stood. The mirrored eyes of the canopy stared at him, and the multiple cannon barrel in the turret below its nose pointed at him. Sean seized Matatu, hurled him to the floor of the emplacement, and then threw himself full length on top of him, just as a gale of cannon fire dissolved the parapet wall. Claudia saw the fountains of earth obscure Sean's distant figure.
"Job!" she screamed. "They've killed him!"
She reached out for him, but Job shook off her hand. He was down on 1 knee, the launch tube of the Stinger across his right shoulder, his face in the reflected firelight, fixed in a mask of concentration as he stared into the screen.
"Quickly! Shoot, quickly!"
The missile leapt from its long tube, leaving a trail of dazzling smoke as it flew towards the crest of the hill. Claudia saw the slight kick in its trajectory as the missile changed to the ultraviolet seeker and lifted fractionally, aiming at the open mouth of the Heinz air intakes. She thought she saw the missile actually fly squarely into the intake, but the resulting explosion was deceptively mild, contained within the shell of titanium armor plate. The hind reeled wildly, throwing its nose high, falling backwards so that its tail rotor caught the rocky hillside, flipping it over sideways. It tumbled and bounced down the slope, rolling end over end, flames billowing from the throat of the air intake, its huge main rotor thrashing the earth and tearing itself to pieces. Claudia sought desperately for Sean and gasped as she recognized him through the dust and the smoke, leaping back onto the parapet and then plunging on up the hillside with Matatu close behind him.
"I reload!"
Job snapped. With a start, she reached for the spare missile tube beside her and helped him clip it into the launcher. The moment the Stinger was reloaded, she glanced back at the lager. Three more of the Hind gunships were airborne, soaring across the dawn. Another Hind was hit and fell on its back, bursting into violent flame as it crashed into the rocky crest of the hill. Then another staggered in flight and curved down to hit the treetops, cartwheeling through them to the earth. As fast as they fell, others rose from their hidden emplacements, with cannons blazing, sweeping down upon the attackers. Job leapt to his feet as a gunship tried to break away, climbing steeply up over their heads. He arched his back, pointing the missile almost vertically upwards. The Hind was 1,000 feet up, but the missile overhauled it effortlessly, and the great machine seemed to wince and tremble to the shot, standing for a moment stationary in the air, before it fell back with its damaged turbos screaming in mortal agony.
A reload!
Job did not even watch the Hind's death, and Claudia leapt to fit another missile tube to the launcher as another Hind came out of the forest directly in front of them. Job braced himself, picking up the image of the Hind in the screen. The Hind seemed to steady itself for an instant, and the blast of its Gatling cannon swept around them like a hurricane. Claudia was blown off her feet, and Job was thrown on top of her, his weight driving the wind from her lungs. But they'd fallen between two round boulders, which deflected the rest of the volley, and the Hind passed over them, only feet above where they lay. The blast of its rotor slashed at them, whipping Claudia's hair into her face so that it stung her eyes like a scourge. Then the Hind slid away like a cruising tiger shark. Claudia, suffocating with Job's weight on top of her and half-blinded with dust, struggled to free herself and was suddenly aware that her hands were wet and that hot liquid was spilling over her and soaking her shirt. Job! The wetness that was dousing her was Job's blood. That knowledge gave her wild strength, and she rolled his body aside and dragged herself out from under him. A cannon shell had hit him high in the upper body, and the damage was horrific. She stared at him numbly and tried to say his name. No sound came from her throat. She reached out and caressed his face, not daring to touch the terribly mutilated body. She felt a terrible sense of loss, and her wail of despair came out in a wild shriek of rage. Then she found herself on her feet, with the missile launcher on her right shoulder, searching the sky for the Hind. It was 400 meters away, sweeping over the forest, picking out its targets and destroying them with terrible blasts of its forward cannon. As she turned to face it, the pilot must have spotted her, for he swiveled the gunship on its own axis, bringing the cannon to bear upon her. Actuator on. She saw the image of the Hind appear in the tiny screen before her eyes, centered it in the crosshair, and the missile steadied into its high-pitched electronic tone. Target acquired, she whispered, and felt no fear as the Hind faced her head-on. Fire, she said quietly, and squeezed the pistol grip. The shoulder pad jolted her as the Stinger launched, and she slitted her eyes against the back blast of the missile as it sped straight and true at the hovering machine. The cannon in the Hind's nose blazed, but Claudia felt only the disrupted air of shot passing close over her head before the missile arrowed into the open throat of the machine's intakes. The Hind had only a few feet to drop before it hit the earth and was engulfed by burning fuel from the punctured belly tank. Claudia was borne aloft on a wave of savage triumph and looked around her swiftly, searching the sky for something else to destroy. But the dawn sky was empty. The burning carcasses of the Hind gunships lay strewn upon the slopes of the hill and amongst the trees of the forest. They're all down, she thought. We've got them all. From the forest, the Shanganis of the Stinger sections were swarming up the hill, breaking into the laager to support Sean's assault. She saw the Frelimo defenders throwing down their weapons and cowering with hands raised, attempting to surrender, and she watched dispassionately as the yelling Shanganis bayoneted and clubbed them like slaughtered chickens. Sean was through the outer defences and into the laager with its service areas and hardened helicopter emplacements. Sean made out the long, drooping rotors of a Hind protruding above the sandbagged wall of its emplacement.
One didn't even get up, he thought as he raced towards it, darting through the narrow entrance and into the deep circular emplacement. The hind, in its blotched camouflage, towered over him. Three Russian ground crew, the pilot and flight engineer, were crowded around the front of the machine. They turned white faces towards Sean and gaped at him. He jerked the muzzle of the AKM at them and they fell back. The pilot was young and thin, with blonde hair and very pale blue eyes. They widened dramatically as Sean touched the tip of his nose with the muzzle of the AKM and said,
"Party's over, Ivan."
Sean lined them up against the sandbagged wall, then looked back at the helicopter.
"Jackpot."
He grinned, euphoric with the adrenaline in his blood.
"We've got ourselves a real, live, working hind."
He indicated the exit, and under the barrel of the AKM, they trooped towards it obediently. There was a fortified workshop excavated into the hillside, almost abutting the hind's emplacement. Sean herded the Russians down into it, and then looked around him. Through the smoke, he saw the Renamo force rounding up the prisoners and searching for loot. He saw one of them bayonet a Frelimo. Furious at this blatant indiscipline, he snarled at the man,
"Get over here!"
It was a measure of his authority that even in the heady moments of victory, the man obeyed him with alacrity.
"Guard these white prisoners," Sean ordered them.
Without looking back, he strode through the lager, reasserting his command, getting his triumphant, howling Shanganis back to sanity. He saw Sergeant Alfonso ahead of him.
"We can't carry much loot away, so let the men take their pick, and then I want limpet mines in the storerooms after everything has been drenched with avgas," he ordered. "We can expect Frelimo to counterattack within the hour, and I want to be gone by then."
"No," Alfonso shook his head. "A General China has moved three companies in between us and the Frelimo. He has ordered you to hold this position until he arrives."
"What the hell are you talking about? China is 2 days' march away on the river."
Alfonso grinned.
"General will be here in an hour. He followed us with five companies of his best troops."
"How do you know this?" Sean demanded.
Alfonso grinned again and patted the radio on the back of the trooper beside him.
"I spoke to the general as soon as we killed the last of the Henshaw."
"Why didn't you tell me this before, you bastard?" Sean growled.
The general ordered me not to, but now he has ordered me to tell you that he is very pleased. He says that you are like a son to him. When he arrives, he will reward you."
"All right.
If we have to hold this place, get your men into the perimeter defenses."
Sean broke off as a Shangani trooper came running up the hill.
"Nkosi!"
As soon as he saw his face, Sean knew it was bad news.
"The woman?"
he demanded, seizing the messenger's arm. "Is the white woman hurt?" The Shangani shook his head.
"Ah, she is safe. It's the Matabili, Captain Job."
With the help of two Shanganis, Claudia had moved Job onto soft ground beneath one of the trees. She looked up and cried,
"Oh, Sean."
Her shirt was drenched with blood. Job's face was a sickly blue-gray color, and the flesh seemed to have melted like hot tar from his skull. Sean touched his cheek, and his skin was as cold as death. He caught Job in his arms and held him to his chest with all his strength.
"Job," he whispered.
He reached up and cupped his head. He laid his own cheek against Job's and held him like a lover.
"We should have made it."
Still hugging Job's quiescent body, he began to rock him gently.
"We've come so far together. It wasn't fair to end it here."
Sean's grief was terrible to see. It was too private, too vulnerable, and yet Claudia could not tear her eyes from his face. He began to weep. Matatu had crept in quietly and crouched behind Sean. Like Claudia, he respected Sean's mourning, waiting for him to master its first unbearably bitter pangs. Sean spoke at last, without looking round, without opening his eyes.
"Matatu."
"Ndio, Bwana."
"Go and find the burial place. We have no time to dig a grave. Yet he is a Matabili, and he must be buried, sitting up, facing the direction of the rising sun.
Andio Bwana.
Matatu slipped away into the forest, and at last Sean opened his eyes and laid Job gently back upon the earth. Sean climbed the hill swiftly, passing the first string of Renamo porters. China was taking everything he could carry, including boxes of helicopter spares and hundreds of jerrycans of avgas. The lines of porters were heading back into the wilderness towards the river, but Sean paid them scant attention. His role was played. He was eager to get Claudia across the border to safety. However, over all his urgency lay the nagging uncertainty. Was China going to stand by his word and let them go? He found General China with his staff and the captured Russians in the command bunker. The general looked up from the map he was consulting and smiled affably as Sean entered.
Colonel Courtney, you were magnificent. A famous victory. All debts between us have been paid. You are free to go.
He smiled and held out his hand.
I have convinced our Russian here to pilot the Hind for me, and Sergeant Alfonso has orders to escort you and your beautiful young American to the border.
Sean ignored the outstretched hand, and China lowered it to his side. His smile had a sly and foxy slant to it.
I wish you joy, and I'm sure you do the same for me.
He turned back to his map, leaving Sean for an instant nonplussed. It was incomplete. It couldn't end like this. Sean knew there was more to come, but General China began dictating orders to one of his officers in Portuguese, leaving Sean standing uncertainly. He turned abruptly and ducked out through the entrance. Only after he was gone did China lift his head and smile after him. It was less than 2 hours since sunrise, but they seemed to have lived a lifetime in that short period, Sean thought, as he glanced back at the hilltop lager. Smoke drifted from its crest, and the last column of General China's porters was disappearing into the forest below it. As Sean watched, the captured Hind helicopter rose slowly out of its emplacement and banked steeply away into the west. They all stared after it silently as it dwindled to a speck. Then Sean broke the spell.
Let's go!
And they started forward at an easy jog trot.
Less than 100 kilometers, and not that hard. 2 days, if we push it.
Scouting ahead of them, Matatu came across a few scattered parties of Frelimo, and they were all retreating. Although they were forced to detour further northwards than Sean had planned, Matatu steered them away from any contact with the Frelimo, and they made swift progress. At nightfall, they stopped to eat and rest. Alfonso made the scheduled radio contact with Renamo headquarters and gave them a position report. They feasted on tinned goods looted from the Russian stores, and when the moon rose, they went on. It was almost midnight before Sean called a halt for the night. He made a mattress of cut grass, and as Claudia drifted off to sleep in his arms, he whispered,
"Tomorrow night, I'll give you a hot bath and put you between clean sheets." "Promise," she sighed. "Cross my heart."
From deeply ingrained habit, he woke an hour before first light and went to check the sentries. Alfonso threw aside his blanket, stood up and fell in beside him. When they'd made the sentry round, they paused on the edge of the camp.
"Now, what you told me about South Africa, is it true?"
Alfonso asked unexpectedly.
"What did I tell you?"
"That men, even black men, eat meat every day."
Sean smiled in the darkness, recalling the conversation.
"Sometimes they get so sick of eating beef," he teased, "that they try chicken and lamb, just for a change."
Alfonso shook his head. That was beyond belief. No African could ever tire of beef.
"How much does a black man earn in South Africa?" he demanded.
About 500 rand a month if he's an ordinary unskilled labourer. But there are many black millionaires.
500 rand was more than a man earned in Mozambique in a year. A million was a figure beyond Alfonso's imagination.
500?
Alfonso thought about that for a long time.
Would there be work for a man like me?
He asked with a diffidence that was completely out of character.
My brother owns a gold mine, Sean told him. I could get you a job the day you arrived at the mine. You could be a supervisor within a year, a shift boss in 2 years.
How much does a supervisor earn?
2,000,
Sean assured him. Alfonso was stunned. His Renamo pay was the equivalent of a rand a day, paid in Mozambique escudos.
I would like to be a supervisor,
he murmured thoughtfully.
Better than a Renamo sergeant? Sean teased,
and Alfonso chortled derisively.
Of course, in South Africa, you would not have the vote, Sean ribbed him. Only pale faces get to vote.
Vote? What is a vote?
Alfonso demanded, and then answered himself.
I don't have a vote in Mozambique. They don't have the vote in Zambia or Zimbabwe or Angola or Tanzania. Nobody has the vote in Africa, except perhaps once in a man's life to elect a president for life and a one-party government, he snorted. Vote? You can't eat a vote. For 2,000 rand a month, you can have my vote.
Anytime you come to South Africa, come and see me.
Sean stretched and looked at the sky. Dawn was only a short time away.
There is something I must tell you,
Alfonso whispered, and his altered tone caught Sean's full attention. Alfonso cleared his throat in embarrassment.
We have fought side by side, he said.
Like lions, Sean confirmed.
I have called you Nkosi.
You have honored me thus, Sean said formally, and I have called you friend.
Alfonso nodded in the darkness.
I cannot let you cross the Zimbabwe border,
he said with sudden decisiveness, and Sean rocked back on his heels.
Why not?
You remember General China has a man in Grand Reef Air Base? The one who helped us on the raid?
Yes.
General China spoke to him on the radio this very morning from the lager of the Henshaw.
Sean felt a cold wind blow down his spine.
He ordered him to let the Zimbabwean army know that it was you who led the raid on Grand Reef and stole the missiles, and that you would be crossing back into Zimbabwe through the Honda Valley, and they must wait for you there.
Sean's gut knotted with shock. He was stunned by the cruelty of the trap China had prepared for him. The fury of the Zimbabwe High Command would know no bounds. Sean was the holder of a Zimbabwe passport, a document of convenience, but one which would make him a traitor and a murderer beyond any help. The trap was closed. The Renamo army behind them, Frelimo on either hand, and the Zimbabwean army ahead. They were to be hunted down like wild animals. Think, Sean told himself. Find the way out.
We must go southwards, Alfonso said. We must go to South Africa.
We? Sean stared at him. You want to come with us?
I can't go back to General China, he pointed out. Not after I have betrayed him. I will come with you to South Africa.
That's a trek of 300 kilometers through Frelimo and Renamo. We've got to get across a heavily guarded railway line and the Limpopo River and find enough to eat in a land that has been burned and devastated by 10 years of civil war.
In South Africa, we will eat meat every day,
Alfonso pointed out cheerfully.
Will your men follow you? Sean asked.
I will kill those that don't,
Alfonso was matter of fact.
We can't let them go back to General China.
Right, Sean agreed. And you will report on the radio schedule that I have crossed into Zimbabwe. We'll be able to string China along for 4 or 5 days. You better talk to your men now.
Alfonso called in the sentries, and in the grey light of dawn the faces of the Shanganis were sober and intent as they listened to him describe the southern paradise to which he would lead them. They travelled cautiously southwards all day. The closer they drew to the railway line, the slower their progress became, and they spent much of their time hiding in the dense ebony thickets until Matatu came ghosting back to assure them that the way was clear. In the late afternoon, Sean left the main party, hiding in a bushy ravine, and went forward with Matatu. He was gone for almost 2 hours, and the sun was setting when he reappeared silently at Claudia's side.
The railway line is a mile ahead. There is a lot of military traffic and panicky guards. The crossing is going to be tricky. As soon as the moon comes up, I'll take another look.
Alfonso rigged the radio aerial and made his scheduled contact with General China's headquarters. And as the moon pushed its silver pate above the trees, Sean and Matatu slipped away into the forest. A mile south of their position, they found a place where the line crossed a narrow stream. Originally, the bush must have been cleared for 100 yards on each side of the line, but a thick secondary growth had been allowed to spring up along the banks.
Sloppy Frelimo bastards, Sean muttered. That'll give us some cover.
The line crossed the stream over an embankment and culvert. There was a guard post on the approaches, 50 yards up track. Through his binoculars, Sean watched a Frelimo sentry saunter down to the bridge over the culvert. He leaned on the guardrail and lit a cigarette. The glow of the cigarette marked his progress as he ambled back to the guard post. Sean and Matatu withdrew quietly. They had been gone for 3 hours, and it was a few minutes before midnight as they approached the camp. At the head of the ravine, Sean paused to give the recognition signal, the liquid warble of a nightjar. When the reply did not come, he repeated the signal. Still there was silence, and he felt the first tickle of alarm. They circled the ravine cautiously, and in the moonlight Matatu picked up unexpected spoor and squatted over it, frowning with alarm. Sean whispered,
"Who? Which way?"
"Many men. Our own Shanganas."
Matatu lifted his head and pointed to the north.
"They are going out, leaving camp."
"Going?" Sean was puzzled. "Oh, God. No."
Swiftly, quietly, he closed in on the camp. The sentries he had set before he left were gone. Sean felt panic rise.
"Claudia," he whispered,
suppressing the urge to shout her name aloud. He slipped the AKM onto fully automatic and went down on his belly, creeping in. The Shanganis were gone. He made out the shape of Claudia's body, wrapped in a blanket exactly as he had left her. Just beyond her, another body lay crumpled in the dappled moonlight. He saw the sheen of wetness on the back of the man's head.
"Blood."
Sean rushed to Claudia, sweeping her into his arms. She gasped and cried out, groggy with sleep.
"Sean, what is it?"
"Thank God," he murmured fervently. "I thought..."
He set her down gently and went to where Alfonso lay. His pulse was strong and even.
"Claudia, bring the flashlight."
In the beam of the flashlight, he examined Alfonso's scalp.
"A nice little blow."
He pressed a field dressing over it and bound it in place.
"What happened, Sean?"
Claudia demanded anxiously.
"The Shingani have gone," he told her. "They obviously didn't fancy the walk or the destination. They bashed Alfonso and took off back to General China."
Alfonso groaned and reached up to touch his bandaged head. Sean helped him sit up.
"By this time tomorrow, our old pal General China is going to know that we are on the run and exactly where we are headed."
Claudia stared at him aghast.
"What are we going to do?"
"There is only one road still open to us. We keep going."
Matatu led them back to the railway line, then slowly along the stream bed to the culvert. Once he signaled them to halt. Then, after a few minutes, he signaled them frantically to hurry. They heard footsteps and voices along the track, and the next 100 paces seemed like the slowest and longest Sean had ever covered. Then, at last, they were into the forest.
"We've made it!"
Claudia whispered joyfully. Sean squeezed her hand, and they kept going. When the dawn paled out the stars, they stopped, and Sean allowed them to drink for the first time, 2 swallows each. At sunset, Sean cooked a pot of maize meal porridge on a tiny smokeless fire, while Alfonso turned the radio to the Renamo command frequency. There was a clutter of garbled, broken-up traffic on their wavelength, probably Frelimo transmissions, but at last they heard their call sign. Alfonso acknowledged and made a fictitious position report that placed them far north of the railway line on a march back to the river.
"They fell for it," Sean gave his opinion. "Looks like the Shangani haven't reached base yet."
They had by the following night. General China's voice came clear and loud.
"Let me speak to Colonel Courtney."
Alfonso offered the microphone. Sean pushed it aside and frowned with concentration as he waited for the next transmission.
"You have yet to disappoint me, Colonel."
China's voice came again, mellow and affable.
"It would have been totally unsatisfying if you'd merely blundered into the arms of the reception committee I'd arranged for you. So, the game is still on. I wonder how you must feel at this change of role, Colonel. You, a great white hunter, are now the game. And I am the hunter. Where am I, Colonel? Perhaps closer than you believe. You must guess. You must run and hide. When will we meet? And how? The time is now 1800 hours, Zulu. I will call you on this frequency at the same time tomorrow, Colonel. That is, if we have not already met."
They marched hard that night, and all next morning Matatu led them southwards through abandoned fields and past deserted villages. In the evening, while Alfonso was stringing the radio aerial, Sean studied his field map and marked in his dead-reckoning position. Matatu slipped quietly into camp, and he and Sean exchanged a few words.
"What is it?" Claudia asked.
"Matatu has seen a great deal of patrol activity. Frelimo or Renamo, he can't tell which."
There seemed to be a much higher level of radio traffic, too, most of it in Shangani or African-accented Portuguese.
"They're moving patrols into a stop line," Alfonso grunted.
"Renamo?"
Sean asked. Alfonso nodded. At that moment, the radio crackled sharply, and a voice spoke very faintly, in a guttural language that Claudia could not understand.
"What language is that?"
"Afrikaans," Sean replied shortly. "Quiet, listen."
But the transmission faded out abruptly.
"That was almost certainly a South African military transmission, probably a border patrol on the Limpopo. We must be getting within extreme range."
Sean checked his wristwatch.
"Well, it doesn't look as though General China is going to entertain us this evening. We'd better get ready to march."
Their progress was slower this night. Twice before midnight, Matatu cautioned them to wait, warned by his sixth sense of danger ahead. He went forward to scout the track and found the ambush that had been set for them. Each time they were forced to make a slow and stealthy detour. After midnight, their luck changed for the better. Matatu came across a path running directly southwards and discovered that only a short time before, a large detachment of men had passed along it. Sean seized the opportunity.
"We'll use their spoor to cover our own."
They hurried along the path until Matatu's sharp ears picked out the tiny sounds that the Renamo patrol was making. They moderated their pace and trailed them at a discreet distance. Keeping in contact with the enemy, maintaining the strict interval that was the line between discovery and concealment, was a delicate and eerie business. But they were moving at almost double the pace they could have hoped for. A little before dawn, the Renamo patrols stopped. They crouched in the darkness and listened to them setting up an ambush. Once the ambush party was settled in, Matatu led them on another detour to meet the path again further on, and they struck out southwards once again.
"We've covered 25 miles, by my reckoning," Sean murmured with grim satisfaction, as the first delicate light of dawn paled the eastern stars. "But we cannot risk moving further in daylight. Matatu, find us a place to lie up."
They'd moved into an area of wet ground on the approaches to the Save River, and now Matatu led them deliberately into the tall swamp grass, picking their way between shallow open lagoons from which the mosquitoes rose in grey clouds. The water covered their tracks. Matatu discovered a dry island, only inches above the level of the floodwaters, and after they had eaten, they curled up on their blankets. Claudia woke with a sense of panic, held down firmly, the palm of someone's hand clamped painfully across her mouth.
"Quiet," Sean breathed in her ear.
He released her and rolled over to look out through the screen of swamp grass. She did the same and peered out across the shallow waters of the lagoon. The girl was slim and graceful, just past puberty, for though her features were sweet and childlike, her breasts were round. She wore only a ragged loincloth pulled up between her long, coltish legs, and her skin glowed in the late afternoon sunlight like burnt molasses. As she waded softly through the lucid, warm waters, the girl held a reed fishing spear poised to strike. She was already so close that with a few more paces, she would stumble over them. Abruptly, the girl froze. Then she whirled and darted away. In an instant, Sean was racing after her. He swept her up under his arm, knocked the spear out of her hands, and carried her back, kicking and clawing. Trembling, she stared up at the men who surrounded her. Sean spoke to her in soft, soothing tones, but she would not reply. Then Alfonso questioned her, and the girl made a hesitant response.
"She is living here in the swamps to hide from the soldiers," Sean told Claudia. "Renamo killed her mother, and Frelimo took her father away. She escaped."
They questioned the girl for almost an hour. How far was the river? Was there a crossing? How many soldiers were there at the river? And as she replied to each question, the girl's terror abated. She seemed to sense Claudia's sympathy, and looked towards her with a childlike trust.
"I speak English a little, miss," she whispered at last,
and Claudia was startled. "How did you learn?"
"At the mission, before the soldiers came and burned it and killed the nuns."
"Your English is good," Claudia smiled at her. "What is your name, child?"
"Miriam, miss."
Sean looked up at the sunset.
"Time to move."
"What about the girl?" Claudia asked.
"We'll leave her," Sean said.
But something in his voice worried Claudia. She started to follow him as he stepped into the water, and then she looked back. The black girl squatted, staring after Claudia unhappily. Behind her stood Matatu, and he had the skinning knife in his right hand. Realization dashed over Claudia like a huge wave of icy anger. "Sean!" She was shaking with anger as she called him back. "You're not going to murder this child?" Her voice was shrill with horror.
"Claudia, we can't leave her here. If they catch her, it would be suicide."
"You bastard!" she screamed at him. "You're as bad as China."
"It's our lives, don't you understand? It's survival. This is a hard, cruel land. We can't afford the folly of compassion."
"Compassion and conscience are all that separate us from the animals."
She drew a deep breath.
"If you value what there is between us, you won't say anything more. You won't try to rationalize what you almost did to this child."
"You prefer to be captured by General China?" he demanded. "This child won't hesitate to give them our exact whereabouts."
"Don't, Sean. I'm warning you."
"All right, then." Sean reached out to take her hands. "I'll do whatever you say."
You want us to turn her loose to report to the first Renama patrol that comes along?
I'll do it.
Claudia's voice was cold and determined. We'll take her with us. Sean dropped her hands.
With us?
You said you'd do whatever I say. He opened his mouth and looked at the black girl. She understood enough to know that her life was at stake, and that Claudia was her savior. When Sean saw the expression on the child's face, suddenly he was filled with shame and self-disgust. It was an alien sensation. During the Bush War, the scouts had left no witnesses. This woman of his was turning him soft, he thought. Then he smiled and shook his head. Or perhaps she was simply humanizing him.
All right. The girl comes with us.
Claudia turned and lifted the girl to her feet. She opened her pack and dug out her spare shirt, a camouflage Renamo sweatshirt from General China's stores. The shirt hung half down Miriam's thighs and satisfied Claudia's sense of decorum. The girl was delighted, her terror of a few minutes before forgotten.
Thank you, Donna. Thank you very much. You're a good lady.
All right, Sean intervened. Let's move out.
Only as Alfonso took her arm did the girl realize she was being abducted. She broke into a passionate protest.
Damn it, Sean exploded. Now we really are in trouble. She isn't alone. She's got a brother and a sister hidden in the swamps. Two kids so young that they can't fend for themselves. Damn it, damn it. Now what the hell do we do?
We fetch the children, and we take them with us also, Claudia stated simply.
Are you crazy? We aren't running an orphanage.
Do we have to go over this one more time? Claudia turned her back on him and took Miriam's hand. Where are the children? We'll fetch them. It was almost dark when they reached the tiny island where Miriam had hidden the children in a clump of papyrus. When she parted the thick green stems, two pairs of huge dark eyes stared out at them. A boy. Claudia lifted him out. He was 5 or 6 years of age, skinny and shivering with fright. And a girl. She was younger, not more than 4 years old, trembling and mewling softly.
This is madness, Sean growled.
Do shut up, Claudia snapped. What are their names, Miriam? The answer was so long and complicated that even Claudia looked daunted, but she recovered quickly. I'll never pronounce that. Well, we'll call them Mickey and Minnie.
Walt Disney will sue, Sean warned.
But she ignored him and wrapped Minnie in her blanket. You'll have to carry her, she told Sean matter-of-factly. And Alfonso can carry Mickey. Before the night had half run, Miriam had proved an asset that far outweighed the additional burden of the two children. She knew the river with the intimacy of a swamp creature. She went ahead with Matatu and guided him through the labyrinth of islands and lagoons, picking out the secret pathways that saved them hours of wearisome exploration. A little after midnight, when Orion the Great Hunter stood directly overhead, Miriam led them out onto the bank of the Rio Save and pointed out the ford through which a man could wade. In the 4 long, tortured days and nights since they had left the river, Claudia had not complained once. But Sean realized she could not maintain this pace much further. She was running just ahead of him, and her legs were floppy with exhaustion. He grinned fondly. This woman was tough, with a spirit as resilient as Damascus steel. He reached forward and tapped her shoulder.
Ease up! We'll take 10.
He helped her down to sit with her back against a tree and passed his water bottle to her. Give Minnie to me. Claudia's voice was husky with tiredness. Sean swung the little girl off his back and placed her in Claudia's lap. Alfonso had rigged the radio, and almost at once he picked up the South African military traffic. It was much stronger now that they were closer to the border on the Limpopo River. For almost half an hour, Sean listened, learning the voices and call signs of the units within range. At last he felt he had identified the South African border headquarters.
It was using the call sign Kudu. Sean waited patiently for a lull in the military traffic, and then he keyed the microphone and spoke in Afrikaans.
Kudu, this is Mossy. This is a storm sending. Do you read me? Kudu.
A storm sending was the call for a top priority message. It was the radio procedure they had used back in the days of the Rhodesian Bush War. He hoped that the South African commander's military experience went back that far. Mossy had been Sean's call sign. A long silence followed. Then the radio came to life.
Say again your call sign. Kudu, this is Mossy. I repeat, Mossy. I request a relay to General Delarey, the Deputy Minister of Law and Order.
Lothar Delarey had been Sean's control back in the 70s. Since then, he had risen to high political office. Kudu would surely know who he was, and hesitate to refuse a request for relay to such a source.
Mossy, this is Kudu. Relay to Delarey, presently unobtainable.
Kudu, this is life and death. I will call you on this frequency every 6 hours, until you reach Delarey.
Do it recht, Mossy. We'll keep a 6 hour listening watch for you. Tot ziens.
Sean and Claudia lay close in each other's arms and whispered together softly.
I didn't understand what you were saying on the radio.
I was speaking to a South African military base, trying to contact someone I know. During the Bush War, although I was in command of the Rhodesian Scouts, I was also reporting to the South African military intelligence. The South Africans and the Rhodesians were allies. Delarey was my South African control. Since the war, I've continued sending him reports, anything hostile I have picked up.
He owes you, does he? She asked. He owes me plenty. Besides which, he's a cousin on my grandmother's side.
But the following evening, as they ate handfuls of maize porridge huddled round the radio, an excited voice speaking in Shangane said,
"Very close now."
The reply came immediately.
"Keep going hard. Don't let them escape. Call me as soon as you catch them."
Sean looked across at Matatu.
"That was China on the radio," he told him in Swahili. "His men are on our spoor. They boast to him that they are very close. Are there any tricks we can use now, old friend?"
"If we keep the women and children with us, there are no tricks," he admitted. "We leave a spoor that a blind man can follow. The only trick we have left is to fight them. And after that, we are dead, my Bwana."
"Up," Sean said, and they ran on through the forest. Sean lay on his belly between two rocks and looked out over the tops of the Mapane forest. Away towards the south, the dark green belt of trees was just visible in the uncertain light. It marked the position of the Limpopo River.
"So close," he lamented. "We so very nearly made it."
Matatu lay amongst the rocks nearby, berating himself.
"I am a stupid old man, my Bwana. You must send me away and get yourself a clever young one who is not blind and decrepit with age."
Sean guessed a Renamo observation post must have spotted them as they crossed one of the open glades between the hills. Without warning, a sweep line of tiger-striped figures had rushed at them from out of the Mapane.
"Alfonso," Sean called, "have you got the radio rigged? If I try to raise the aerial, those baboons down there will shoot my testicles off."
Alfonso growled from amongst the rocks.
"It's almost line of sight to the river," Sean told him brusquely. "Give me the aerial."
He raised himself on one elbow and threw the bundle of wire as far out down the slope as he could reach, and then stooped to the radio set. When he turned on the power, the control panel glowed feebly.
"Kudu, this is Mossy. Kudu, do you read me? Kudu, this is Mossy."
Then, unbelievably, a voice answered him.
"Mossy, this is Ubas. I read you, strength 3.
Ubas! Oh, God! He breathed. Ubas!
Ubas, the grandfather, was Lothar de la Rey's code name.
Ubas, we are in deep shit here. Request an immediate hot extraction. We are 5 adults and 2 children. We are holding a small kopje approximately 20 kilometers north of the Limpopo. Do you read me, Ubas?
I read you, Mossy. What was your grandmother's maiden name?
Oh, sod you.
Double-checking his identity at a time like this.
My grandmother's maiden name was Santen de Tiri. And she's your grandmother also, Lothar, you rotten bastard.
Okay, Mossy. I'm sending a puma in for a hot extraction. Can you hold out for 1 hour longer?
Pull finger, Ubas. We've got gooks all over us.
Give them hell, Sean.
And then the battery died.
They are coming,
Sean grinned at Claudia.
They're sending a puma helicopter to take us out.
Then his grin faded, and all their faces turned slowly towards the north. There was a new sound in the dawn, still faint and far off. But they all recognized it. It was the sound of death. They watched the hind come down from the north, sweeping in low over the forest, a great hunchbacked monster, the first rays of the rising sun reflecting off the cockpit canopy like huge glowing red eyes. Sean placed his arm over Claudia's shoulders.
What now?
She whispered, and he showed her the grenade in his right hand. The hind was very close now, coming in swiftly, swelling in size before his eyes.
There is still a chance, he told her. Come here, Minnie. Come, quickly.
He called in Shangani, and the tiny black girl tottered across to where they lay.
Hold her,
Sean whispered, and lifted the back of the child's ragged skirt. Sean pushed the grenade into her knickers, down to her buttocks between which it nestled.
Keep that for me, little one,
he whispered in Shangani.
It's a secret. Don't take it out. Will you do that for me, my little flower?
Minnie stared at him with dark, adoring eyes and nodded solemnly. Sean gave her a hug. The hind's turbos were almost unbearably shrill as it came in towards them at the level of the hilltop. General China was sitting in the weapons cockpit, so close they could clearly see the triumphant smirk on his face as he lifted the microphone to his mouth.
Good morning, Colonel Courtney. The chase is over. Tell your men to lay down their weapons, please.
Do it, Sean shouted at Alfonso. I have a plan. Trust me.
Matatu and Alfonso rose slowly to their feet with arms held high. China's voice boomed out again.
Take your clothes off, all of them. I want no surprises.
Slowly they stripped and stood naked before him.
Now the women.
Claudia stood up slowly. Defiantly she unbuttoned her ragged shirt and pulled it over her tousled head. Her breasts were white in the early sunlight. Miriam stripped quickly, then held her little brother's hand.
And now, Colonel Courtney, the last is the best of all the game.
Sean threw aside his tattered clothing. 60 yards to the helicopter, he estimated. He took Minnie's hand. At the foot of the hill, China's men burst out of the forest. Obediently, the hind pilot edged the huge machine in closer. 30 yards, 25 yards. Sean concentrated on the opening of the air intakes to the engines. They were the size of garbage bins. The hind steadied in the air and hung in front of them. In the cockpit, General China twisted his head to peer down at the advancing Renamo, and Sean seized the moment. He took the grenade from the back of Minnie's skirt and closed his hand over it. As it came out, he pulled the pin and reared back like a baseball pitcher, just as China looked back at him. He concentrated on the starboard engine intake and hurled the grenade, willing its flight into the small circle of the intake. It exploded as it hit the spinning blades. As Sean seized Claudia and Minnie and buried them face down, the hind's engine tore itself to pieces,
and the helicopter rolled onto its back, cartwheeling down the slope onto the Renamo, avgas fountaining from its ruptured main tanks. Then the Hind went up in a sheet of flame. They watched it burn, the flames sweeping through the grass at the edge of the forest. A shift in the wind carried a new sound to them, and Sean looked towards the horizon. The Puma helicopter was still a dark speck, but it was coming, swiftly, the sound of its engines rising on the wind.
"Put your pants on, darling," said Sean, hugging Claudia. "It looks as though we've got company."